open up today's session. Kate?
Great. Thank you, Jean, and welcome everyone to the last day of our 2020 Designing Construction at Hazardous Waste Sites virtual symposium. For those of you that are not familiar with the DCHWS series, EPA and the Corps of Engineers actually started putting on the DCHWS events over 12 years ago. We ran into some challenges about 6 or 7 years ago, and that resulted in a collaboration between EPA's Superfund program and the Society of American Military Engineers, or SAMEs, Philadelphia, and then later Denver Metro Post, to put on a series of symposiums, mostly in-person symposiums. This one's virtual. It's a webinar series and other training activities. I want to thank SAME. As I mentioned before, this is our sixth year of co-sponsorship, and without them, we could not put on these events. For myself, Kate Garuffi, as EPA's Superfund representative in the co-sponsorship, I'm the master of ceremonies for our in-person and now virtual events, as well as setting up the technical program. So I hope you've enjoyed this program if you were here yesterday and the day before, and you're going to enjoy it today. There's going to be some reminders to fill out some evaluation forms at the end as we're continuing to grow our program and do future symposiums and webinars. I highly encourage you to give me some feedback on the technical content, what you liked and what you didn't. This event, when we do it in person, is a day and a half for the six panels, and it's a similar format. So if you like the format, I highly encourage you to look for future in-person events. As I mentioned yesterday, we have over 350 registrants and of note, a number of SAME members and 94 young professionals. I wanna thank everybody. We have representation both internationally and all over the United States. I know this time is not ideal for everyone, and we appreciate you hanging in there with us. We did the best we could under the constraints of moving a lot of in-person events virtually. So again, thank you so much for being here, being present, and participating. So today is our last day. Day one, we talked about bringing groundwater remedies to the finish line using passive technologies such as phytoremediation and carbon amendments. We followed that with combination technology implementation, design and construction lessons learned. Yesterday, we changed gears a little bit, talked about some thermal remediation projects, and then the use of modern technologies to improve our DRA. Today, we're going to go with some project management themes, different types of sites, sediment sites, residential sites, groundwater sites, talking about overcoming challenges like urban high access issues and also why planning is so critical for successful projects. So I'm looking forward to these two panels. The panel format is a moderator and three panelists. We shoot for 20 minutes for each panelist or a straight 1 hour of presentations followed by facilitated Q&A. You will notice a Q&A window on your Adobe Connect platform. I encourage you to not hold your questions till the end when we have facilitated Q&A, but to type them throughout. In addition, when you're asking questions, please indicate which panelist you'd like to ask the question to, panelists A, B, C, or the entire panel. That helps our moderator sort of cue the questions up for specific folks. So again, don't be shy. Put your questions in. We're tracking them, and we love to see your questions, and it's a great Q&A when we have a lot of questions. So I'd also like to thank briefly our SAME Denver and Philadelphia posts for their support in getting this program together, running registration, getting our event sponsors. So again, thank you to Todd Bragdon, Anita Larson, Sean Quick, and David Riott in the West, in the Denver Post, and then Amy Beth Thor, Karen Budiak, Jamie Wright, and Gordon Arujo, who really helped us from the Philly Post. And I can't say enough about our sponsors. I'll thank you guys again by name at the end, but in the context of time, thank you now. You guys are the best. We appreciate you. And without you, we couldn't have put this on. So we're going to have some introductory remarks, and not to cut into Brett's time, I'm going to do a brief bio and intro and then turn it over to him for introductory remarks and the pledge. So Brett is the president of the SAME Denver Metro Post, who runs our West Symposium. Brett graduated from the Colorado School of Mines with his undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering, and he also holds a master's in engineering management from the University of Colorado at Boulder. Brett has a number of certifications and credentials, including professional engineer, certified energy manager, lead accredited professional, and project management professional. Brett serves as the manager for the Colorado Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Sustainability, Energy, and Engineering Program. Some of his noteworthy achievements: Brett was responsible for starting the energy and water program for the Colorado Army National Guard in 2002. And as part of his duties, oversees the energy and water conservation efforts of over 1.5 million square feet. Brett also serves as the agency's principal mechanical engineer, providing engineering oversight to all building renovations and new construction projects. As a certified building commission professional, Brett manages the commissioning program for the Colorado Army National Guard. Brett served multiple Brett served multiple terms on the National Guard Bureau of Energy Working Group. So with that, that was a long list of credentials. Brett, here, it's over to you. I'm going to flip it over to Ledge.
Very good. And let me just make sure that I can get my video going. Kate, do you see my video by chance? Not seeing it here. Here we go. Start my webcam. Got it. Here we go.
I see you.
I'm getting figured out. You see me? Okay, great. All right, so you can see me. Perfect. All right, well, thank you so much, Kate. That was a fantastic introductory, and I'm so pleased to be here today. And on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Philadelphia Society of American Military Engineers Post and my very own Denver Metro Post, Society of American Military Engineers, I'd like to welcome everybody to the final and probably the most exciting day of our Design and Construction at Hazardous Waste Site Symposium, virtual symposium, first one of its kind. Fantastic opportunity and fantastic event. First, I'd like to thank Kate and Jean for all the work they've done to help bring this event to fruition, and frankly, for the coordination in the background to make sure that all of your presenters and opening speakers today have a great session and a really seamless transition. From my very own post, the Denver Metro Post, I'd like to thank Todd Bragdon, Anita Larson, Sean Quick, and David Rioff for the work they've done to support years, not just this year, but many years of a successful DCHWS symposium. We've titled it DCHWS West, but it's fantastic that we can be a part of a larger DCHWS effort nationally this year in this forum. So it's fantastic, and thanks to not just the folks in my post, but the folks in the Philadelphia Post and the EPA as well. I had a chance to hear Dana Stalkup on Monday, and of course Rear Admiral Mark Handley with AECOM and the incoming or the president-elect for SAME National speak and open remarks the last couple days. And I think they really set the stage that what we're learning here in the DCHWS is so vitally important, not just to industry, but frankly to our national resiliency and national security. It's great to have such a large audience and interested individuals. I'll also say that of course we've got multiple event sponsors here, and I'd like to reiterate Kate's position on that we couldn't do this without the sponsors. So thank you for being a sponsor even in a virtual format, and we hope that you'll continue to be sponsors moving forward for this event. I'll just kind of wrap up before I go to the pledge just by saying, hey, I'm honored to be a part of this event, and frankly to be the final opening remarks. It means a lot to me and the Denver Metro Post, and this relationship that we've built over the years has meant a lot. So with that being said, I think it's time for us to go ahead and do the Pledge of Allegiance. So if you could all take a moment and follow me in the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It's great to be living in such a great country, and for this country to be able to impart such fantastic learning opportunities. We're all blessed, and I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to Kate. Have a great session.
Thank you so much, Brett, for the opening remarks. So without further ado, we're going to jump into our panel 5 session. You guys can see an overview of the panel and our three moderators and what they're going to be talking about. I have the honor of introducing our moderator, Andy Bullard. Andy is a senior environmental scientist, sediment specialist with CDM Smith. He has over 23 years of experience in site characterization and assessment in the design, construction, and management of management and long-term monitoring of environmental remedies, and he focuses on contaminated sediment systems. Andy holds a BS in Environmental Science from the University of Delaware and an MS in Environmental Management from Duke. He's a licensed professional or project management professional, or PMP, and a leader of CDM's contaminated sediment practice areas. Highlights of his career include being part of a team currently managing some of the nation's largest and most complex contaminated sites and serving in 2011, 2013, 2015, and 2017 as a program chair for the International Conference on Remediation and Management of Contaminated Sediments. So basically, Andy likes sediments, especially when they're contaminated. So with that, Andy, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jean, Brett, and Kate. I really appreciate it. It's a privilege to moderate this panel on overcoming remediation challenges in urban and high access settings. In the first four panels, we've heard a number of interesting talks on innovative remediation technologies, supporting technologies, and combining technologies for specific cleanup applications. In this panel, we have three high-quality presentations delivered by three experienced environmental professionals that highlight the implementation of remediation approaches at densely populated, heavily used, tough-to-tackle sites. I'm sure everyone has their own experience in crowded, active, challenging surroundings, and that the presentations we're about to see will resonate. Our presenters for this panel are, first to the mound, Sabrina Forrest from EPA Region 8, middle relief is Kirk Craig from Geosyntec, and closing is Keith Sheets from Jacobs. I'll start by briefly introducing Sabrina Forrest for our first presentation. Sabrina is an environmental scientist with EPA Region 8 in the Superfund and Emergency Management Division. She holds an environmental studies degree from the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. She has 27 years of experience as an EPA Superfund RPM, an EPA Superfund Site Assessment Manager and NPL Coordinator, an EPA Emergency Response and Site Assessment Contractor, and a Natural Resource Technician. She currently leads a multidisciplinary, multi-agency team working on the Colorado Smelter Superfund site. The team includes EPA, EPA contractors, Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, Pueblo Department of Public Health and Environment, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Corps contractors. Sabrina spends her free time outdoors with her friends and family, enjoying fun on two wheels, rock walls, or skis. And as an East Coast and specifically Pennsylvania skier, I can definitely say I'm jealous of that. Today, Sabrina will be discussing her team's ongoing efforts at the heavily populated Colorado smelter site, despite the challenges of COVID-19.
Great. Thank you all so very much. Just a quick check there. Can everybody hear me?
We can.
Oh, fantastic. So thank you very much, Andy. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak at this year's Design and Construction Symposium. I'm going to speak about the Colorado Smelter Superfund site in Pueblo, Colorado. I'm going to give you some background about this residential site, then get to our response after COVID-19 impacted our project in mid-March 2020, and how we kept the accelerator on this fast-moving project during our challenge, the pandemic. Before that, though, I'd like to give a shout-out to our large project team, which has been instrumental in our rapid progress at the Superfund site. Since late 2011, when the site appeared headed for the national priorities list, our EPA remedial program worked closely with our community involvement, technical support risk assessment programs, as well as our state and local health department counterparts, the Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. And in 2014, we added our RIFS contractor to the mix to help us characterize the site. And then from 2017 to present, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers project delivery team and their cleanup contractors. All of these folks have been a crucial part of meeting our residential cleanup completion goal, and we are moving along really well with that. Our success has truly been built on a collaborative process with frequent and transparent communication and constant vigilance regarding noting the need for and taking action when process improvements must be incorporated. I also want to thank my remedial teammates, Jamie Miller and Christina Baum with EPA, Kristen Kapitayas and Doug Jamison with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Without their support, keeping myriad other site issues moving, and specifically Christina Baum's drafting this presentation and taking the reins on our contractors' COVID-19 plan updates, I may not have been able to join you all today, and I'm really glad that I could be here today. as Jamie Miller often says, teamwork makes dream work. This team has just always been amazing to work with. So here I want to go back to a little bit of background. The Colorado Smelter Superfund site is located in Pueblo, which is about 2 hours south of Denver in south central Colorado. The site includes the historic Colorado Smelter, and you can see, I think, Gene, can I have the arrow? Thank you. All right, so here in the center, we've got the Colorado Smelter that I'm circling over. And that was a former American Smelting and Refining Company, ASARCO Smelter. It's surrounded by residential areas all around it, some natural areas. And we're calling Operable Unit 1 the community properties surrounding the former smelter area. OU2 is sort of the donut hole of the former facility. And we have some outlying natural areas that are also part of Operable Unit 2. So Colorado Smelter was a former lead and silver smelter located here in Pueblo. And Pueblo was, as you can see here, home once to five smelters, as well as an active steel mill. So we still have this active steel mill facility here. It's a state-managed RCRA facility. But we had these other four smelters that were also in the area in the late 1800s. And in 2011, we actually did a removal action on the Blend smelter. And 1995-ish, there was a cap put on this topmost smelter, the Pueblo smelter. This community that we're working in is very much a working class environmental justice concerns type of community. And they very much embrace and are proud of their rich immigrant history. In the surrounding neighborhoods that we work in, Grove to the north, the Bessemer neighborhood, which is west of I-25, and then Eilers and Bojantown, which are the primary areas to the south and east of the former smelter area. So a little bit more on the history of this area. In 1921, there was a major flood that impacted Pueblo. Approximately 1,500 people died in a flood that impacted 300 square miles of the Arkansas River Valley, so about 30 miles west of Pueblo to the Kansas state line. And about 600 homes were carried away. The St. Mary's Church was flooded, and it actually, the St. Mary's Church was formerly up in the Grove neighborhood, and then because of that flood, they moved it south into the Eilers neighborhood so that it could be up in a higher location. St. Mary's Church was interesting in that some brick from the former smelter stack was actually used to build a school that is part of the St. Mary's Church complex in our Eilers and Bojan area. Between 1949 and 1959, I-25, Interstate 25, was built, and it divided the neighborhoods. And this is similar to the Vasquez Boulevard I-70, where I-70 divided neighborhoods, but this area was divided, and then the Arkansas River, because of that flood, was moved. It was moved from this location into a concrete-lined channel, and that is another area with some highway development and some road subdivisions that has created other divisions in the community. In the mid-2000s, CDOT, the Colorado Department of Transportation, began the environmental impact statement to look at realignment and widening of this I-25 area, which is one of the most dangerous areas of I-25 throughout the state of Colorado. So our site structure, I mentioned a little bit, Operable Unit 1 is our community properties, and our former smelter stack was located about right here, and so we looked at about a half a mile radius around that former smelter stack for aerial deposition of arsenic and lead and other metals from that former smelter, and trying to characterize about 1,700 residential properties within that area and about 200 non-residential properties within that area as well. But our focus really has been residential properties since 2015. Operable Unit 2, again, is the former smelter area, so we see this purple outline here, and then we have some other natural areas. I believe I have another slide coming up that will show a little bit more of the outlying natural areas that are within Operable Unit 1, but better characterized as part of the Operable Unit 2. Operable Unit 2 is about 45 acres. It still has some building remains on it, and a total of about 200,000 square feet of slag piles and some soils that are overlying slag, and that deeper slag has yet to be characterized. We also have within this area several active commercial properties that are on the eastern edge of this purple outlined area. So a lot of our concern in the, you know, community properties, Operable Unit 1, is how do we characterize this area quickly, effectively? How do we do our outreach when we know that we've got a lot of people that may not be home? They might work multiple jobs. We're working with vastly a lower income minority populations, but we know that we've got a lot of potential significant lead concerns because 98% of the homes are pre-1978 lead paint ban, and 50% of these homes are rental. Many of them have bare soil yards, so that we don't have any landscaping or grass for a lot of them to maintain some sort of a protective barrier against lead contamination. We have challenges with small residential lots, so there's a lot of frequent communication and a lot of handwork that needs to happen as we're working for consent to get onto properties and then do our cleanups. And one of the things that we identified early on in our remedial investigation and feasibility study for the community properties was that we were actually seeing some pretty significant levels of elevated lead from indoor dust, and about 30% we believe was track-in from soils into homes. And so we really wanted to be able to have as much of an impact as we could, quickly characterizing but starting the cleanup process as soon as we could for these community properties. So we saw this need for concurrent remedial investigation and then moving into proposed plan record of decision process, getting on the ground and trying to get our cleanup started just as quickly as we could. So I guess as a little bit of a time frame, we started our sampling characterization in earnest in December of 2015. 6 months later, had data from 100 homes for indoor dust, 300 homes for soil, saw enough of a concern that we started doing emergency cleanups, indoor dust cleanups, and then by September 2017, had our decision document going, and were shortly after that, by early 2018, were able to start our soil cleanups. And we really are trying to have as much concurrent soil cleanup and indoor dust cleanup as we possibly can. Our status right now on sampling is 90% complete with the soil sampling and about 60% complete with the indoor dust. And unfortunately, the COVID-19 pandemic definitely has impacted the situation for indoor dust sampling and cleanup. One of the good points, though, about moving this along in this concurrent nature is that we have our soil cleanup status already at 54% complete. And one of the other backstory pieces of this is that we received some significant support from headquarters for accelerated cleanup funding to try to be done with our residential cleanups by 2023. And so we're a good deal toward that goal with the community properties, especially on the soil side, and actually we're greater than 54%. I know the slides show here 54% complete, but we're actually closer to 60% complete on the soil cleanup status. And we are still at the 30% indoor dust complete because of delays with the COVID concerns. So a little bit on the former smelter area. It's a really large natural area. As you can see here, we've got some slag areas, and this is just a small portion of it. There are quite a number of slag areas that are throughout this natural area. And we've done a little bit of characterization. 1 year of air sampling was completed in 2018, and some shallow soil, surface water sediment, and pore water sampling has been completed. But we still have a significant amount of characterization that we would like to do in this area. But we really wanted to focus on operable unit one, because that's where the greater amount of risk is presented. Where people live has been shown to be about, 70% of where they spend their time. And our risk evaluation indicated, we'll have the biggest impact if we can address contaminated residential soils and indoor dust. One of the things that on operable unit two, former smelter area, that we're grappling with is that we've got homeless camps that have been located there for years, despite landowners trying to discourage it. And we've put caution signs out discouraging folks passing through there or using the area, but it's an out-of-the-way area and people continue to return to it. We aren't able to fence it because there's an active rail line along the west edge of all of this. So even where people have tried to put up some fences, it's just not successful at keeping folks out. So one of the things I want to get into that's our biggest challenge here in 2020 has been COVID-19 and the fact that we are trying to maintain this accelerated successful project and just keep things rolling along. So our last week in the community was the week ending March 13th. We had one of our normal weeks of community advisory group meetings and team meetings and everything else. And it was concurrent with the state of Colorado and Pueblo County declaring public health emergencies and, all the national news about COVID-19. So we halted our field operations and started talking with health and safety folks, and the contractors spoke with their corporate health and safety. And we started trying to figure out what do we need to do to continue our work and see how and if we could get back to the field quickly, keep our workers safe, keep residents safe. There wasn't a lot for us to go off of, honestly, but we were really, we had a group of people that was willing to be proactive on this. And so our contractors started looking at CDC protocols, State of Colorado Health Department protocols, and developing resumption plans, really focusing on those CDC compliance recommendations, State of Colorado Health Department recommendations, and then practical approaches to keep residents and workers safe. Amazingly, we had them draft plans. EPA reviewed them, the State Health Department reviewed them, our local health department reviewed them, and the Corps of Engineers, everybody reviewed them. In fact, there was some level of scrutiny all the way up to EPA headquarters to make sure that folks were comfortable with the idea of us doing work. A critical piece was that our local health department is a core program member. They have a lead program grant. They were also on the front lines with the COVID response. And so the same people were reporting back to us that, hey, we think that you all being outside is probably the best use of resources, and you can keep going on at least soil sampling and soil cleanup while putting some certain things in place, and we instituting such things as daily check-ins. We'll go into that a little bit more. We were not able to continue any indoor work. And so we have, as of September 2020, had the cleanup crews submit their COVID-19 compliant resumption plan, and those are currently being reviewed and revised, and we're hopeful that we can get moving again on these interior cleanups, because ideally we have our soil cleanups as well as our indoor dust cleanups done within 8 weeks of each other. We know that we're just over 200 properties behind on interior cleanups right now, but that's going to continue, that gap is going to continue to increase. So it's really important for us to try to figure out how that we can get back into these communities and do the interior cleanups. I'm going to skip forward real quick. I had something a little out of order. So slide 10 and 9 were a little bit messed up there. So I've moved on to work freeze here. And so one of the things that we really felt was helpful was halting all of our field operations and taking stock of everything, making sure that folks and their corporate health and safety felt like we could do this work, that we actually had adequate personal protective equipment, and we weren't taking anything away from the frontline workers that might need PPE. And so doing outdoor work, that was something that we could easily do. And so we had our crews develop their resumption plans, all kinds of review, as I mentioned, and the State Health Department was also super supportive of us continuing to do that work. One of the things that was also really helpful to us was that we had daily pre- and post-workday health monitoring for COVID symptoms in our sampling and our cleanup contractors, and that they would report that to us. Late April, we had daily conversations about what was going on in the field, what was going well, what might not be going well, does something need changed. Thankfully, everything was going well for our crews. There were a few times where we had some symptomatic crew members, but their COVID tests came back negative. There was continuous review of updates or potential updates and what can we do to continue to improve things, and look at CDC web pages, the State Health Department's web pages for their guidelines and updates or anything new that might be coming out from the governor. And then ongoing discussions with contractors about contingency plans. One of the things that was really important in our contingency plans was tracking if you have a certain number of people that are exhibiting some symptoms and they have to be sent home, being okay with sending them home, but being able to rework the numbers of people on a crew so that some of our cleanup work primarily could continue to progress. And we never really were impacted by this. I think it all was a really fantastic example of the crews taking all of these protocols extremely seriously. And one of the things here that I want to go through are the various elements of these plans and things that helped us be successful. So having our social distancing in place during tailgate meetings and during the cleanups, that was a relatively easy thing to do. Even though we have small yards, we had the ability to have people distance easily in the lay down yard for health and safety meetings, but even when they're in a small front yard or backyard and they've got some people on small pieces of equipment due to the small size, or some people on an actual, you know, shovel, they're able to maintain 6 to 12 foot distance very, very easily. Contractors providing some masks, and this was not N95, we weren't taking PPE from frontline workers, individual coolers, and so that people could supply their own food and water, hand washing stations in the field, daily health screenings, temperature checks before and after the workday was done, and an example of this is if a temperature check, if someone was coming onto the lay down yard and there was a temperature, they didn't make it even the whole way down into the lay down yard. They were turned around and they had to go home until we had 72 hours of temperature free. If a COVID test was needed, get results on that. One of the big pieces was frequent communication with the residents and property owners and rescheduling if they are not feeling well, if residents are not feeling well. Looking at interior sampling and cleanups, we did have one minor win in that if we had a vacancy at properties for 2 weeks or more, then we could go in and sample. And if that status was maintained or could be shown to have been maintained and a cleanup was needed, then we could do some interior cleanup. So we've done about 9 interior sampling and I think 4 interior cleanups on vacant properties in these few months. Modifications of work duties for high-risk employees. And then rather than all the FaceTime, because we have learned that FaceTime with our community members is the best way that we can work with them. We have had to rely somewhat more on phone calls, but if we can have conversations from some distance in a yard, we still do try to do that. So with our resumption of work, we were able to, as I said, get back to do some critical work only 2 weeks after our stop. We did these daily check-ins. In April, we stopped doing phone calls, and we still, to this day, get daily emails from the sampling and from the cleanup contractor allowing to give us messages and summaries about what they're doing, are they being impacted, is health good, and we have had no issues there. A couple folks that have stayed home with some symptoms, but we've had all negative tests as far as COVID tests that have come back. And ongoing incorporation of any sort of guidance that has been evolving from local health department, state health department, as well as CDC. Here's a picture of our new normal. This is a picture of a sampling area where we've split our XRFs into 2 separate rooms. Sample our soil prep. We've got, you know, one individual in 2 different spaces, and before they come into this space, they have a health check and temperature check, and then they report back to us on that with their daily email reporting. And then we provide management updates where we were providing daily updates to our management for a while. Now we're providing a weekly update to our management and continuing to have a level of comfort that we can continue to do our work. Our accomplishments, I think the biggest thing that I want to say is that, you know, we've really had consistent open communication with our EPA project management, upper management, Corps of Engineers, all of our respective contractors, state and local health department partners, preemptive action and backup plans, and continual situation monitoring with communication and plan adjustments. We've really been successful and we've stayed on track. We have been able to keep all of these residential cleanups moving, you know, though focused on soil. We have had 0 COVID cases within our contact crews. And just to illustrate how important this is, we've got typically 65 to 75 people on the ground helping to do sampling and cleanup. I'd say 6 to 12 people may be in an indoor office situation, either helping with the sampling, analysis prep, consent, and on the cleanup side, office administrative work that needs to happen to keep these cleanups moving along. But 0 cases within any of our contractor crews. And again, we're at 91% complete with soil, 60% complete with indoor dust, and 60% complete on our soil cleanups, and about 30% done with the indoor dust. So we're just going to keep things moving along. We're hoping that we can get back to the interior cleanups just as soon as possible. And that is all. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sabrina. Appreciate that great presentation. So Kirk Craig is our second presenter. Kirk is a professional engineer with GeoSynTech and has worked in the engineering and environmental field since 1996. He holds a BS in zoology from the University of Florida and an MS in environmental sciences and engineering from the Colorado School of Mines. He currently manages the GeoSynTech Phoenix, Arizona office and serves as a faculty associate teaching senior-level environmental engineering at Arizona State University. His environmental engineering experience includes the design, construction, operation, and optimization of more than 60 remedies using a variety of technologies, including a number of new and emerging technologies. Kirk, in his spare time, favors camping with his family, which in times like these is a great passion to have. Today, Kirk will be discussing an innovative pulsed ozone microdiffusion sparging approach to remediate PCE at an urban Arizona State Superfund site.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Let me know if you have any problems hearing me. Before I get started, I have to say, Sandra, I've been in Arizona for 17 years, but I'm from Colorado, and coincidentally, my grandpa worked at that smelter facility. But so anyway, back to Arizona. Before I get started, I have to give some credit to a couple of folks. A colleague of mine, Trevor Carlson, he is in our Saskatoon office. However, Trevor spends a lot of time supporting Phoenix, and really, I have to say, is the brains behind the secret sauce that is really making this an exciting site. And also, Mike Morales is the ADQ project manager. And I take some time, too, to get some accolades to ADQ. I've worked with a lot of state agencies and federal agencies all over the country. And for the past 5 years, ADQ has done a really phenomenal job of moving a number of their state Superfund sites through their remedial progress. They're very open to innovative technologies and combinations of the technologies. And Michael Morales is an example of how they get engaged in these projects. He has a vested interest in this and has really been a part of making this happen. So moving on here, the 24th and Grand Wharf site, I got to give you a little context of this. It's actually two sites. So if you, the picture on the right, the square on the upper right hand of the site area is one plume, one source area, and then the little gold square to the lower left is another source area. And they are two plumes that somewhat commingle, and that's an interesting component of that I'll get into a little bit more. And the Arizona State Superfund site you'll hear referred to as WARF. It's as some of you may know, it's called the Water Quality Assurance Revolving Fund. So a little bit more about the site. Phoenix in general, they call it the valley, and it's a broad alluvial valley. So that makes for some very complex hydrogeology. Groundwater is deep around the valley. At this site, it's relatively shallow. But because of that alluvium, the lithology here can be very heterogeneous and layered. So there'll be intermittent beds of fine grains, and sometimes you'll get into cobbly areas and very transmissive soils, but a mix, a very layered mix. And that plays a key role in how we assess and address this site and the type of technologies that we were able to use. And specific to our site, groundwater flow, it's pretty fast. It's 70 feet per day at the site, and also that plays a key role in how successful this technology is. I want to tell you a little about, I mentioned how there's two plumes, and prior to our involvement on this site, now this is a long plume, and it's miles long, and it goes under a combination of very nice residential, commercial, some light industrial, but a mix of areas, very hard to access some of these areas. And prior to us getting involved, there wasn't a differentiation of this plume. They knew there were two source areas, but they couldn't really tell. So we use, and I recommend anybody to use these type of visualizations, environmental visualization systems. I'll spend a little bit of time talking about it, because if you see the cross-section here, I'm looking across the plume for B, and B prime, and we were able to, there were quite a few wells on this site, so we vertically profiled the site, drew all this data into EDS, and what we were able to tell is the actual path that the two different plumes are traveling in, and that's really important with the context of the lithology and the type of remedy that we were capable, or that we're able to implement, because one, as you can see, for example, the plume on the right, that's our plume coming from our source area that is to the southwest, so the lower source area. And now we see that on a three-dimensional plane, that plume is running on a completely different three-dimensional plane, and you can see that it's hung up in some finer-grained soils. The other plume, which originated far away, has now been pulled down into some coarser-grained materials, and there are a lot of drinking water production wells in the area that actually can drag these plumes down. So now we were able to focus in on this shallower plume and know how it's different from the combined plume. And here's a cross-section of it. So now you're looking at the transect of AA prime, looking down this particular plume that we're going to be talking about. And you can see how it is hung up in those finer grain soils. It breaks through at points, but it really isn't until you approach the MCL of 5 micrograms per liter for PCE, which is what we're focusing on here, where they overlap. So the site itself, all right, the site is actually a former it's a former dry cleaner, and now it's a CVS store. And like I said, very busy streets around it. There's some pretty nice houses. You'll see, if you can see in these images, with pools to the upper right, to the northeast. And it was crucial that we don't impact CVS's operations. By the way, too, as with Sanders sites, we were doing all this, still maintaining these field activities with implementing some pretty stringent safety procedures during the height of COVID. But there was a former SV system on this site, and we wanted to, and it was very successful, so the vadosome got remediated, and we wanted to come up with a way to use as much of the existing infrastructure as we could. And the one good thing about, you know, we're going to be injecting ozone, there's a really good monitoring well network there, a lot of soil vapor probes and things that we could use to our advantage. Trying to get this thing to progress here. There we go. So anyway, then we were going to do an ozone sparge pilot system, and I'll get into the what differentiates this. If any of you have used ozone, I'll touch on that a little bit more. What makes this special a little bit later. Drilling in Arizona, I talked about how this we're in a big alluvial basin and how often the drilling can be challenging here. Direct push is primarily out of the question in the valley, unless you're just really doing some shallow. Very superficial things, and typically we have to use sonic because of the cobbles and the heterogeneity of the soils. This site, though, we were able to use auger rig, and that's important because of the residential and then nearby and the sound with respect to sonic, and also the speed. It's also, though, important to note that because of the type of wells we're installing, these wells could pressure up to 100 psi. And I'll explain that a little bit more when I get into the ozone technology. But ozone is also, if anybody's ever worked with it, kind of a wily compound. So the wells have to be constructed very well with really good well seals. Ozone tends to find its way through cracks in things. And we use, I won't get into the helium, to pressurize test this, which is even wilier. Anyway, wells are very important, and they have to be constructed correctly and in the right screen in the right intervals. All right, so I told you there's, again, working in these rural areas and some of the fun challenges you come up against. There was a former SV system, and to not get too much into the SV system, this particular SV system was kind of like two conic boxes stacked on top of each other. And because of the heat in Arizona, had a large heat exchanger, and the upper conics box kind of worked as a plenum, so to speak, to help try to keep the system cool. We decided that upper portion wasn't necessary, took it off, took the site to ADQ to over to another PC remediation, and set the top. ADQ didn't have a place to put the top of the system, so we just put it in the compound, and we put our work plan together and strategies to get this early response action, the EPA, you know, equivalent of an IRA, the ERA in place. Meanwhile, a homeless person moved in and opens up a pretty good, I think, stolen bike parts shop there. And even that, we found out they climbed up on our compound wall and went up on the adjacent building and took the air conditioners down and parted those out as well. He was actually, the ADQPM was on site chatting with this gentleman and telling him that the police were on his way when he rapidly decided to take as much of his business and move it elsewhere before the police could get there. And we never saw him again, but this is important because in areas like this, we tried cameras, we tried razor wire, and they would just throw blankets over it. Cameras, in some of these areas, they'll just put their head down and go knock the camera down. So we have ADT there. And we have a formal security system. And if any of you use motion sensors and ADT on sites like this, the challenge is the false alarms. So, but it's very important, very expensive equipment. We've had break-ins on these sites before, And a damage to a system like the one we're going to talk about is significantly more painful than to a typical SCE system or the like. SCE system, we wanted to be as efficient. We wanted to have as low impacts on this property as we could, because it's already been torn up. This CVS had already been impacted by this. Is the installation of SCE systems. And Trevor has had some really good success, and so have we, snaking tubing through existing SVE pipes at other sites. There's a lot of reasons why you might want to get tubing in an SVE pipe. If you've got water in your SVE lines and you want to pressure pulse it out, if you want to add amendments, things like that. So we've done it on a few sites. We wanted to try it here. Well, unfortunately, the contractor who installed this did a lot of hard 90s. There was a big grade change here, and they did quick hard 90s really close to the compound. So as much as we tried, we use these little parachutes, and you pull like a twine, and with pressure, shoot it through the pipe, and then you're able to then pull it back and pull the tubing through. Well, we tried, we couldn't do it. So again, with all effort of keeping impacts minimal to the CVS here, who had no stake in this at all, they were just being cooperative with ADEQ, we decided, since we're only putting in PVC conduit, the PVC is basically a conduit that has 3/8-inch tubing in it, we could go very shallow. And the traffic rating in this parking lot was minimal, and the only spot really where they would cross it would be delivery trucks, and we didn't even care if it flexed a little bit. So we were able to put 12-inch trenching and fill it with a slurry, which is automatically compacted very fast in days, and with very little impact to CVS. And remember, this was during COVID-19, and I can say I visited the site and can say firsthand I was witnessing runs on toilet paper and paper towels. So this was very high traffic at this time, the CVS. It was almost in panic mode. So we contemplated those things at length during our tailgate safety meetings and really considered how to incorporate that in our COVID social distancing component. So anyway, then hot patch asphalt, boom. This really was slapped in fast to get these transmission lines. Now, a little bit about the system. This system was actually we got it used, which, we were trying to save ADEQ money. It was a very successful system at a confidential pharmaceutical site, did a good job. It generates up to 25 pounds per day of ozone, and we've now upgraded this up to 50 pounds per day. But that's not the secret sauce. These can happen really, and I can't get into it too much, but the way we inject this ozone, we've come up with a way to inject it where it gets into the dissolved phase and pulse it into the aquifer. And what that has resulted in is amazing radius of influences relative to what you typically see for air sparge or ozone sparging through with the typical air sparging type of mode. So that is really where our proprietary approach has reaped the benefits that I'll get into here in a little bit. Here's what we've seen at this site. We fired up the system and the site directly down gradient, the real indicator well. And remember, this is a pilot study. But the easy thing about this system, unlike other chemical oxidation, is that we can now just modularly expand it. We don't have to mobilize and inject another amendment. We really thought about other types of chemical oxidation technologies at this site, but because of the busy streets and the length of the plume and being under residential, multiple mobilizations and things were really problematic. 87% increase in VOCs across PC and really all the VOCs and daughter products. And within 250 feet of the injection points, we saw a 20% increase. And this was all after only 6 weeks. And since we've seen a steady decline since. And I say the canal, if you can see it, the picture on the lower right, this next bullet here, ozone was detected in monitoring well headspace across the canal. It may be hard to see, but there's a canal that runs lower to the site. And we could see ozone, and that tells you when it gets into the dissolve phase how far down gradient it went. Almost 1,000 feet down gradient we're seeing ozone in the headspaces of our wells. And then there were some cross-grading wells that were monitored really to just make sure that we didn't see any spreading of the plume. Significant rise in ORP, that's what that last bullet was on the other slide. And with this, we definitely changed the redox state of the aquifer significantly. And the interesting thing, and I'll get into the next slide, that has some repercussions that immediately reversed themselves, because after 14 days, it was restored back down to even lower than it was. And why that was important, yes, we did see at the injection area, within the treatment area, increases in metals, more notably chromium and uranium. But backing up a slide, during this shutdown period here, 14 days, they rapidly dropped back out and to levels that were as low, if not lower, than post-injection levels. So that's nice. We know but that's something to take in consideration if you have different types of aquifer conditions, and we have these highly aerobic, fast-moving aquifers here in Arizona. So the wells, since they do change the chemistry of the aquifer, the mineralogy of the aquifer is affected, and that does cause precipitation of iron and manganese, and the wells could tend to foul. So we're seeing that in a well now. Hopefully we can redevelop the well, but it's something to keep in mind for this. But the wells, like I said, they may need to be replaced after time. Sorry, I lost my cursor there. I need to get back onto the arrow. So we put a lot of ozone into the ground, and you compare this again. The nice thing about this, again, in this technology, is that a few things. One, we're putting a micro diffused type bubble back into the ground, so we're getting dissolved phase ozone, and like you see in air sparge. Now we're also rolling the aquifer over, so we're getting movement. In three dimensions in the plume where we're injecting, and then it's generated on site, so we don't have to handle big injections and mobilizations, and the ROIs are large. So the number of wells and the amount of impact to the community is much less significant. And this is just the pilot. We've already injected 5,000 pounds of ozone to date, and we're gearing up or ready to gear up to go full scale. But in this case, the pilot is the pilot system is the full scale system. We just now to potentially need to bring more wells into play, into the rotation. So in summary, going back to things, I do want to point out that EDS type modeling was really excellent for CSM refinement. And that is important when you're selecting nuanced remedial technologies that are subject to site-level scale fate contaminant transport implications. Pilot testing is critical. Even if I was doing an SV system in really homogeneous soils in Arizona on a hydrocarbon site, you still want to do a little bit of a pilot, but especially in these cases, and especially if you have more organic soils, or tighter conditions, and the inability for aquifers for the redox conditions back to change like we saw, it's important to do pilot testing. And not every technology is appropriate for every site, but I have been using more gaseous remediation technologies lately, and they do have a place, just because the ability for the gas to move and the type of RIs, whether it's in the vagus zone or the aquifer. These systems are problematic. I said we got a used system, but we spent a lot of money. Ozone systems are inherently hard on equipment, so that the maintenance can be high. We did see dissolved phase, plus 400 feet plus, I said downgrade on the other side of the canal, 80% reduction in 6 weeks. We're going to go to full scale within 2 years. And we're also doing this now on another Arizona State Superfund site, seeing the same preliminary results. And during the Q&A session, maybe I'll expand on a site with some mixed constituents that will be implementing this technology in Anaheim. So it looks like I'm hitting right on 20 minutes. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Andy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kirk. That was great. Appreciate it. And I appreciate you keeping the time there, too. So Keith Sheets is our third and final presenter. Keith is a registered geologist and a senior project manager with Jacobs in Portland, Oregon. He holds a BS in geology from the University of California at Santa Barbara and an MS in hydrology from New Mexico Institute of Technology and School of Mines. And maybe Keith can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Santa Barbara is the banana slugs. He has over 25 years of experience managing small and large multidisciplinary RIFS and remedial design and construction projects from initial characterization through site closure. In his free time, Keith is a bona fide sailboat racer locally around Portland and to finish lines as far away as Hawaii, which is ridiculously impressive. So today, Keith will be discussing the use of a novel riverbank cap to control sheen and dissolved contaminant discharge at a highly complicated Superfund sediment site.
All right, thanks, Andrew. No, the slugs are in Irvine, Santa Barbara, the gauchos. Okay, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. All right, great. I'm going to talk about, I guess it moved already, this shoreline cap we installed on a riverbank in the Portland Harbor. I'm going to go over some of the details and the tasks that were taken, the project had, and talk about this oleophilic biobarrier, which is this sort of new technology that is we implemented here, and it's been implemented a few times across country, but it's kind of new for controlling sheens on riverbanks. I'll talk a little bit about our CSM, some of the details about the design and how things changed when the Portland Harbor Superfund rod got issued in the middle of our project, and then I have a bunch of photographs. I have a lot of slides, but a lot of them hopefully will go fast here, where I will show you some of the construction aspects of the project. So the task on this project, started from doing a focus feasibility study as part of a source control measure for controlling upland pathways to the river in advance of the rod being signed for the Portland Harbor project. It's sort of an ECA style feasibility study. We had to push that through with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and EPA. I had to bless that. Permitting was quite extensive because we were working below the ordinary high water line. We had a joint permit application for a 404 permit with a 401 permit with the Corps and Oregon Department of State Lands. DEQ was also involved in the permitting process, as well as EPA, National Marine Fish Service, and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife also were weighing in because the Willamette River is an endangered species river due to the salmonids, the salmon and the steelheaders migrating through. We had some state historic preservation office input because we had a pier that was greater than 50 years old that we had to impact. And then the city of Portland had quite a few also permitting requirements and hurdles that we had to get through. As part of the design, we had a large team. We had civil engineers, geotech engineers. Due to the no net rise flood mitigation, we had to do a fair amount of modeling on the river. And then a lot of surveying had to be done to make sure that our no net fill requirements that I'll talk about later were met. And we went through procurement and contracting and then oversight of the construction for building of the cap. The site is a bulk fuel terminal. It's on the western shore of the Willamette River. It's been operating for over 100 years, and in those 100 years, they've had a variety of releases that ultimately made it down to the top of the water table in an area, and we've had sheens entering the river since 2004. There was an interim remedial measure that several extraction wells installed that sort of slowed down the sheens, but not very well. Back in 2011, we installed a 200-foot long, 30-foot deep fiberglass sheet pile wall to cut the source of the product off from the bank. That greatly reduced the sheens, but they still persisted intermittently due to the sort of what we call the stranded wedge between the top of the bank and where the sheens were entering the river. Like I mentioned, the site is within the Portland Harbor Superfund site. Within the rod, there were 10,000 feet of riverbank identified as a rod riverbank, and our site ended up being part of that. And how this affected us is that we were in the middle of design and actually had funding and permits in place for one type of cap, but due to the rod, we had to change our approach due to some additional requirements that I'll talk about here shortly. It was a fairly difficult site, a very steep bank. It's a 2-to-1 slope for the upper part of the bank, and then it grays out into a beach. But one of the other challenges is that the water levels rise up and down 15 feet seasonally on the left side here. At end of summer and end of fall, we have water levels that completely expose the bank. But then in the spring and in the winter, this 15-foot rise in water levels, and the bulk of the bank is submerged. So all of our work had to happen during low river stage. This is a sort of a cross-section conceptual site model. The terminal is built on made land. There's filled land. The original riverbank river had we're sitting on top of a silt. And we had a node, a low flow groundwater zone below the site, and then where the fill occurred, we do have a groundwater discharge zone. Due to the releases, we have a thin 5 to 3 foot thick napple zone sitting on top of the water table, sort of smeared up and down, that was exiting in a very small point, right, sort of elevation between 10 and 15 feet elevation is where the sheens were originating. We installed the barrier wall to cut that source off, but we had this stranded wedge that was persistent and giving us these annoying little sheens that we had to take care of, because it's a water quality exceedance for having a sheen. We looked at inundation amounts, and really the water, because it goes up and down 15 feet, at the place where the sheens were originating, it's inundated somewhere between 10 and 40% of the time through the year. And so that's when we would see the sheens. When water levels would rise above this area, we would start to see the sheens. Mid to late summer and into the fall and winter, you have no sheens at all because the water levels are low. Water levels currently are on the way back up, but not quite yet. But you would start to see them when the water levels intercepted that seep. Sheens are quite challenging. They form where you have this groundwater surface water interface. They form due to seeps, where you actually have product in contact with the water. There's a high spreading coefficient with petroleum hydrocarbons. The water hits it. Doesn't take very much product to make a sheen. A tablespoon will spread out over a very large area. You can have ebullition. You can have erosion and scour where you have, product interacting with the water surface. Other challenges are permitting. Most of these are at areas that are below ordinary high water, so you do need to go through a full 401, 404 permitting process. And then access is tricky because a lot of these banks are steep. You have to either work from the water side or from the top of the bank. And if there's at times a pretty long reach and or access to get down and try to put in a remedy. The current remedies for sheens, they do have some limitations and they have some pretty high costs. You have physical barriers such as a barrier wall, and then you have to have associated groundwater extraction frequently and then treatment of that. Other remedies include absorbent barriers, oleophilic clay barriers, reactive core mats. Those have limitations because they have limited absorption capacity, and some very large clay barriers are failing because sort of the product will sit in a certain spot, and it's like a candle burning through wax, and some very large remedies have failed. And so I know Colorado State had been approached by several oil companies where they had some issues with sheens and failures, and they've developed this oleophilic bio barrier to be a low cost and also a sustainable sheen remedy. And it's this material is it's a reactive material where it allows the NAPL to be trapped and then enhance the natural biodegradation that is occurring at these sites where you have interfaces of product with surface water. The OBB is a geocomposite that is sandwiched. It's a high HDPE geocomposite that's has directional flow in two directions, and then it's sandwiched between an oleophilic geotextile. This is used in as a landfill leachate liner. It's relatively inexpensive. It's $1 to $2 a square foot. But how it works is that you lay it across where you have your sheen, and frequently, and it works very well where you have tidal fluctuations, where you would have 1 or 2 times a day flushing of oxygenated water coming into your mat and also into the bio barrier, and it enhances the oxygen and the existing microbes in the soil to help actually biodegrade the NAPL. It spreads at the NAPL hits this geotextile and it spreads it across, and then the interior core allows the oxygenated water to flow in and out. There is a patent for the use of this technology that is held by Colorado State. They are issuing agreements to implement this, and they have a royalty fee for using this. But how it works, and I'll go through this, you lay the biobarrier down on the surface. You sometimes have to use a leveling layer. And then in order to keep this from eroding, you need to put some sort of structural cover over the top. And depending on where you're at and the amount of wave action, that can vary. But you can put riprap armoring over it or sand itself if it's a low energy area. One of the things you have to take into care of is what is the loading that you have. It works very well where you have sheens. I don't think it's been installed anywhere where you actually have active seeps or you have minnows and rivulets of product coming out. We did a calculation on the volume of product that's exiting when we do have our sheens. Using a little tool, I believe NOAA put it together, where you use a color and a surface area, and you can calculate, the total volume that's causing the sheens. And we were in the tablespoon sort of per event type of sheening events. It used to be quite colorful, but after we installed that barrier wall, it went down to sort of the gray and silver type sheens, which are very, very thin sheens and not a lot of product. And we knew it was coming out at an elevation sort of between 10 and 13 feet. So we focused our OBB and our cap in that area, and we designed it so there were some overlaps of panels in that area of sheen to allow for additional absorption capacity and storage. But, we calculated that this could, even without taking into account biodegradation, it could handle, over 5,000 sheen events. So once the rod was issued, we did have to take into account a lot of extra requirements where we had to control groundwater discharge. Armoring was prescribed where it had to be habitat friendly. You had to take into account flood rise issues. We did end up to take care of our groundwater discharge issue. We layered our cap to where it included a carbon layer this is a transmissive cap, and so we put in a carbon gravel layer on top of the OBB to take care of any dissolved discharge into the river. Armoring is important because of the salmon in the stream. The resource agencies really do not like riprap because predatory fish live in the cracks of the larger riprap, so they really wanted a gravel that was small and rounded. Where we had existing riprap, in the upper parts of the cap, we left it as is, but we also increased our habitat in the lower areas where we were able to cover the cap in this what they call it a beach mix. It's basically a 2.5-inch rounded gravel that's free of fines. We did employ some marine mattresses. I'll have some pictures here in a second to help reduce the amount of fill and also allow us to cover these mattresses in this beach mix. There's very strict floodway requirements for the city of Portland manages for FEMA the floodway. No net fill is and no net rise has to be met. Even a yard of material goes in, you have to make sure that you have to take a yard of material out or you mitigate it. And so in our case, we knew we were adding up to 300 yards of additional material for the cap thickness. We did mitigate on our site downstream of the cap. We took 350 yards out that were within the floodway to help mitigate that. And even though we had a zero net fill, we did still have to prove that because we changed the geometry of the cross-sectional area of the river, we had to show that our cap did not cause any rise of the floodwaters. So we sort of had the sandwich cap. It was a leveling layer over the top of the surface. We put the OBB down. On top of that, we put the 6-inch granular fill with carbon layer. We put a geotextile over the top of that to just separate that from the armoring that went on top. We had several different cap configurations. On the steep slopes, we had riprap. And then in areas where we had habitat to preserve, we put the beach mix on top of that, right on top of the riprap. In other areas, we put the marine mattresses down where we had the beach area and then the beach mix on top of that. We did end up constructing this in two phases. Phase one was in fall of 2017, and all that work was above water. We all done in the dry. And then the following year, we came back and we did more in-water work and worked at times when the water was low enough, and we expanded the cap down into lower elevations. I'm going to run through some photographs of it. This is the start of the phase one. We had very limited access of working at the top of this bank. There's about a 17-foot flat area, and then we had these tanks right behind her. These are active fuel tanks. And so we had a tight working area. We had some protective mats because this is on top of our barrier wall and our extraction wells and so forth. So we cleared off the existing riprap. Because of the steep slope in the upper part of the bank, we had a geogrid that was installed into an anchor trench so that our cap didn't slide off of our hillside. That was our first step. And then we rolled out we put a little leveling layer down, and then we rolled OBBs. These come in these 100-foot long rolls. They're 13 feet wide or so, and you just roll them out, and it's they're fairly flexible. There's a good profile where we have the geogrid on the bottom, we have the leveling layer, OBB layer on top of that, and then on top of that we have the carbon gravel mix, not shown here as the armoring quite yet. Phase two happened the next year. This is the phase one portion of the cap, and then we had these smaller excavators down onto the beach, and we excavated out along the toe of the slope, needed to reduce our cut and fill balance. We excavated out about 2 feet and allowed our spot for our marine mattresses to go in. This is a picture taken on the same day. And even though we're 100 miles away from the ocean, we still have a 4-foot tidal swing daily at the site. And this is beneficial for the OBB. Like I said, we get flushing daily, but we also had to stop when the high tide came in. We were kind of done for the day if we were down working in these lower areas. But this just shows how much, the water covered up our OBB layer. We were working from trying to get the material down onto the bank. We had this slick conveyor truck that had this conveyor that could really shoot the material out. So all of the granular material, the carbon and the beach mix, was shot out from this truck, and they had a remote control that would very accurately place the material where we wanted it. This is sort of the picture of it, of the OBB covered with the gravel, granular layer on top. And the marine mattresses were installed, by hand. They're these 13 feet by 6 feet wide and 9 inches thick that you fill up with a 2 to 4 inch angular cobble. And we layered them in along at this lower portion of the cap. And on top of that, we laid in this beach mix. This is this nice mix that we had to get made up from the local quarry. This is the final completed cap on how it looks. You know, it actually improved water quality quite a bit. You know, it used to be quite, you know, murky in this area, but it's very clear right off of the offshore of our area. We did increase habitat by about 2,000 square feet by building the cap and then covering everything with that beach-friendly, habitat-friendly beach mix. Since the phase one was completed in November, we have not seen a sheen. It's been very effective at stopping. We were seeing daily sheens when the water levels were at that 20-foot elevation. We're going to continue to monitor it, but we have not seen a sheen since. So it has been effective, it is promising, we believe, for these areas where you have these groundwater surface water interfaces and these persistent sheens. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Keith, and I apologize for calling you a banana slug. I meant no offense. So, you know, that brings us to our Q&A portion of panel 5, and I think we're all going to get ourselves up on our cameras to do this. Maybe I'm the last one, maybe I'm the first one. I see Keith. I see Kirk. And I see Sabrina. All right, so thank you to everybody who submitted questions through the Q&A function, appreciate that. So why don't we go back to Sabrina. Sabrina, I think a pretty straightforward question here. You cited in your presentation that people tend to spend about 70% of their time at home. Is that a number that reflects the current state of COVID affairs, or might that number actually be higher? And related to that, is there any relocation of residents during individual property cleanups?
So definitely, I would assume that percentage of time people are spending at home is higher now. This was a citation that we looked at with our proposed plan record of decision. So as of 2017, and you know, a lot of people are spending more time at home. We do know that in our community, we do have people that are still getting out to work, but we assume that they are spending more time at home. The second part of your question, sorry about that. Can you repeat that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Are any residents being relocated during the intrusive activities?
Great question. No, we actually haven't had to do that. When we had some emergency indoor cleanups, we did relocate folks. And prior to COVID, there were no relocations. Subsequent to COVID, focusing on soils, sampling and cleanup, no relocations. We are currently considering whether or not relocations would help us if we can resume interior cleanups. Probably not so much sampling, because the sampling is done with a special kind of a focused area volumetric sampler. And we can keep people in an area away from sampling and PPE appropriate. But on the cleanup side, we're looking at the potential for relocations to help protect workers as well as residents, for sure.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to Kirk here. Yeah, let's go to Kirk here. So, Kirk, you mentioned that you had another site with a mixed suite of contaminants. I was wondering if you could perhaps speak to that briefly and use that to highlight advantages and limitations of the ozone technology, particularly for a full-scale application?
Sure, yeah. The other site, and thanks for asking that, Andy, it does have VOCs, which now we're really confident. It's similar. It's got some lenses of tighter soils. But in addition to VOCs, this site has 1,4-dioxane. And I'm sure as many of you regulators know, the holy grail to 1,4-dioxane in situ treatment. But first, we're going to do a three-tiered approach as our plan on this site, where we think maybe the ozone, just because we get such high concentrations in the groundwater, and we might be able to produce free radicals in with ozone only, can treat the 1,4-dioxane. If not, using the same proprietary approach, we're going to try, in a way, misting and hydrogen peroxide and going for, in a sense, in-situ AOP. And then the backup plan for this, Geosyntec happened across a consortium of microbes that we found an activated sludge bioreactor that we were using at a hazard, for hazardous landfill treatment that is killing it for 1,4-dioxane. We're already piling it at some of the defense contractor sites. So even if we can't get the 1,4-dioxane down with the ozone followed up by combining it with misting and hydrogen peroxide, we will have cleared the site of VOCs and primed it now to have a tertiary plan of bio. So we're really excited about testing this technology first in and of itself on VOCs and 1,4-dioxane. And the limitations, the limitations are just like they are with any. It's a contact sport, right? Even when it's bio. But I do like the fact, and have experienced seeing this, the gas gets more places. You know, even if you do it, say, on the bottom side of tight lithology, it can then work its way up through those clay lenses. And then it'll really rapidly travel through the more transmissive zones where the plume is migrating. So I feel like this, it has really just the same limitations as other contact sport remediation technologies, but from my experience, it does a better job because it gets out in more places. So, yeah. Long answer.
Thanks, Kirk.
Thanks.
That's okay. Appreciate that, Kirk. And Keith, let's go to you. Two questions within one. So you mentioned the use of marine mattresses, and of course the approach was built around the OBB. So why the marine mattresses rather than some perhaps more readily deployable armoring, and why the OBB relative to something else on the market, say like an AquaBlock? Can you speak to those?
Sure. Yeah. So first part of it was the marine mattresses, and that we were down on the beach area where we had habitat existing, and we wanted to limit the amount of fill that we were putting in and the amount of excavation in order to meet the no net fill part. So that allowed us, there was low energy down on the flat part of the beach, and we were able to embed those into the beach and then allow us to cover that with the fish-friendly beach mix. And so those were relatively inexpensive and easy to put together. And we had to have the protection of the OBB, and that allowed us, you know, the marine mattresses are pretty tough, and but they had a thin profile. So it gave us an advantage of not having to do over excavation or putting any formal riprap down there, because you would sort of lose your habitat.
Okay.
And so
go ahead. Sorry, I was just making sure.
Yeah, so the AquaBlock. We looked at AquaBlock. We looked at other, you know, clay. You know, AquaBlock is kind of it is an oleophilic clay that's, I believe, it's more transmissive. However, you know, it does have it's pretty expensive. It can be messy to put in, but it also has the issue of its sorptive capacity, you know, can be met. And so the OBB, it is innovative. There is a risk. You know, I think ours was the second full-scale implementation of the OBB. And so, but it's relatively inexpensive to put in. If it doesn't work, it wouldn't be that hard to take it out and put something else in. But it was it's a novel and you know, innovative technology, but everything that we had seen, it was working in the pilot test and in the other full-scale project that was up on the Hudson Bay. And so that's why we went with that.
Yeah, and as a follow-up to that, was there any consideration given to just simply removing that napple in the stranded wedge?
Yeah, we did look at that. That was part of our feasibility study. However, it was, as you recalled from the conceptual site model, it was at the top of the bank 25 feet down. And in order to get that out, you'd have to do this major excavation up against this very steep bank where you had operating, you know, fuel tanks at the top of that bank. And so you'd have to put a secant wall and a bunch of tiebacks, you know, multiple million dollars just to get out this thin layer of napple that was at residual levels. So, you know, we knew this was just a sheen and not active seeping of product. So capping it was certainly the way to go versus trying to excavate it out.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So I realize that that was not a particularly long Q&A, but I think we are at a point right now where we are going to be stealing time from panel six, and I don't want to do that. So what I'd like to do is thank Sabrina, Kirk, and Keith for these great presentations. Thank everybody for joining and listening. Hope you took some good information away from this. I thought they were great presentations. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. This is Kate. Thanks, Andy, and thanks to our panelists. I just want to, in closing, just bring up, as we're getting ready to talk about another project management panel, one of the things that one of my predecessors at EPA used to say is that every Superfund site is a snowflake. And I think you guys gave some great examples of, you know, how site setting, whether it's in an urban or a high access area, can really impact the way that you deliver design and construction projects. So I appreciate all of your presentations. I think they were great and well received. So thank you, panel five. Jean, let's do a quick sound check and transition to panel six.
All right, thank you so very much. So I'm going to call off names of our afternoon panelists, and when you hear me call out your name, if you could just unmute and confirm you're with us. Cannon, are you with us on the phones? And Cannon, you may be double muted. All right, I'm going to come back to Cannon here in just a moment. I can see him on the line, so Cannon, if you can unmute. Okay, I'll come back to Cannon. Let's see if Kevin, sorry, bear with me. I'm attempting to resolve this audio issue here. Kevin, if you're on the phones, please feel free to speak up and let us know.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can. Thank you. All right, so David, if you're on the phones, speak up and let us know you're there.
I am here.
All right, so we're going to go back to Cannon. Cannon,
and
I can see you on the phone. Are you there? We can hear you now. All right. Fine. Excellent. So, Kate, it looks like everyone's accounted for.
All right, thank you, Jean, so much. And for panel six, I, Kate Garuffi from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, will be moderating the panel. Yesterday, we actually had a presenter for our thermal remediation panel that said she was a thermal guru and loved thermal technologies. I would say for my introduction, I love design and construction project management, so I'm super excited to be moderating this last panel. So what this panel is going to be talking about is planning for success, RDRA project management lessons learned. And to get a better feeling for some of the challenges or impacts that you guys have had issues with designing construction projects, we have three questions at the bottom of your screen. We want to know how many years of project management experience you have with design or construction projects under CERCLA. We're going to be hitting on some climate change considerations today, so we're really interested as to whether you as project management professionals have considered climate change in the preparation of your design and construction work. And last, we have a free form Q&A that wants to know what your biggest project management challenge is to successfully deliver projects. So I can see right now that a bunch of my EPA people are talking because they're talking about contracting. So as I mentioned before, in Superfund, we generally say every site is a snowflake, and it's really hard to bin them, bucket them, take one approach and apply it to another site without considering the site-specific considerations. We have three panelists today that are going to be talking about some great project management lessons learned, thinking about, you know, those intangibles when it comes to successfully delivering a project. So, you know, at uncontrolled hazardous waste sites, we have some of our technical and environmental considerations that may provide project challenges, but there's other issues. You know, EPA is talking about acquisitions here. We're going to be talking about climate change issues. And also, you know, you've got a lot of cooks in the kitchen. You've got owners, you've got designers, you've got constructors. So these three panelists are going to give different perspectives on some of the challenges they had and how they overcame them with different project management techniques. So our first panelist is going to be talking about sediment projects and some of the climate change considerations. So our first panelist is Cannon Silver, who works for CDM Smith. He's a professional engineer licensed in four states, a certified professional in Ohio's EPA voluntary cleanup program. He's a project management professional and an associate environmental engineer for the firm. Education-wise, he has a BS in engineering sciences from Harvard and an MS in civil engineering from Stanford. He has over 25 years of experience as a consultant to private and government clients, including EPA and the Department of Defense, conducting design, construction, and operation projects at over 40 hazardous waste sites, and has authored or co-authored more than 15 technical presentations. So, Cannon, without further ado, it is on to you.
Great. Just want to confirm, thank you, Kate, you can hear me okay.
Yep, you're good.
Beautiful. All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm pleased to share with you today the challenges that we faced planning and then executing a sediment remediation project in the midst of climate change. You will see we recommend considering a new normal for water management design. Okay, so on the second slide, this shows our project site, which was located in the Mid-Atlantic region and included a tidally influenced creek that flowed into an estuary connected to the Chesapeake Bay. The creek itself includes a 500-foot stretch that is non-tidal, a 600-foot stretch intertidal, and a 1,200-foot tidal stretch. The upstream portion of the creek is very narrow, only about 5 feet in width. As you move downstream, the creek width opens up to about 250 feet across. Creek depth varies from just a few inches in the upstream portions during dry periods to about 4 feet deep downstream. The creek is surrounded by an industrial area and a residential area. Prior to remediation, the creek was contaminated with polychlorinated biphenyls, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and heavy metals, including cadmium, mercury, zinc, copper, arsenic, and lead from past industrial operations. The remedial action objectives focused on reducing risk to both human health and the environment from these contaminated sediments. To address these risks, the remedial action selected, along with community participation, a remedy that focused on removing 14,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment via excavation in the dry. In order to create dry working conditions, the design included a temporary bypass system and a series of dams. Per the NEPSES permit, a water treatment system was required to treat the contact water prior to release. Obviously, the contact water is defined as any water that comes into contact with the contaminated excavation area. In contrast, water that was diverted around the creek via the bypass pump around system was not considered contact water and could be pumped around the work area and discharged downstream without treatment. And then following remediation, restoration of the creek included floodplain reconstruction and wetland restoration. So the portion of the design that focused on this bypass pump around system and the dams followed the state guidelines that temporary measures for dewatering and diverting flow from a reach for construction purposes will have sufficient capacity to convey two-year flows. To assess and mitigate for potential risks, back in 2015, CDM Smith, serving as the owner's representative, led a two-day failure modes and effects analysis during the 60% design phase that involved both the client and the design team. And as we brainstormed, we came up with 96 potential risks, two of which related directly to uncommon weather conditions or large storm events, with the potential impact of causing failure of cofferdam or bypass pump around system. That failure modes analysis also identified the potential effects, which included flooding and inundation of the work area, more contact water to collect, store, and treat, and possible recontamination. As recommended actions, a contingency plan to handle larger storms and a safety factor were recommended to be included in the design. So these pictures show and summarize both the design and construction of the bypass pump around system. Now, per that requirement to convey a 2-year storm flow, the bypass system designed 24-inch diameter HDPE bypass piping and large diesel pumps with the capacity to handle a 24-hour storm event generating 3.3 inches of precipitation and producing a flow of 20 cubic feet per second. Then the safety factor was added to handle a 10-year storm that might consist of up to 5.1 inches of precipitation for a total of ability to handle 30 cubic feet per second. The dam system itself consisted of 4 dams, 3 of which were sandbag dams. And each of those dams were designed to handle a 2-year flow event, which included 1 foot of freeboard that was estimated based on hydraulic modeling. The top picture of this slide shows the project area and these series of 4 dams and 3 isolated sections that would be worked on sequentially. Ideally, the sequence would follow from upstream to downstream. Unfortunately, initial delays in obtaining site access in the upper reach of the creek led to the decision to excavate the middle section, this green section first, located between stations 10 and 19. These lower figures show the 2 cofferdams that were installed at these locations. And of course, the water treatment system to meet the requirements of the permit to treat the contact water that was pumped out of the excavation area. The treatment system consisted of sandbag filter, bag filters, and 5,000 pounds of activated carbon filters designed for a treatment capacity of 300 gallons per minute. It's important to note, as you will see later in the presentation, this contrasts to our bypass pump around system, which could handle 30 cubic feet per second, or about 50 times the water capacity of this treatment system. Okay, now we get to the fun part of the presentation, the project challenges that were encountered, which included some dam overtopping and failure. These came from a series of 3 storm events that occurred in the period of July through August 2017. In late July, we received a storm that dropped 5.7 inches of rain overnight. The storm exceeded the 24-hour, 25-year flow event and likely also exceeded the 6-hour, 100-year storm event. Definitely beyond our design. You can see over on the right side the summary of the design of the bypass system, which was designed for the 10-year, 24-hour storm event. Right, and which was even more conservative than the dam 2-year flow design factor. But the fund didn't stop there. Just several weeks later, on August 18th, another 1.5 inches of rain fell within 1 hour, exceeding the 60-minute 2-year flow event, which again overtopped the Station 10 dam. And then days later, a 1.75 inches of rain fell in 2 hours, exceeding the two-year flow event. And again, the dam at Station 10 overtopped. There's some fun pictures on the next slide showing both the dam overtopping at Station 10 and the dam breach at Station 19. The pictures on the left of each of these show what the dam looked like before the storm event, that first storm event in July. As you can see, our contingency plans, or the safety factor put into place, was not sufficient for these storm events. So as a consequence of the overtopping and the breaches, we're impacted both by schedule delays and cost impacts. And not only that, but also concerns of releasing contact water that was untreated. Per our NIPSCI's permit, any water that entered the excavation area was considered contact water and had to be treated before it could be discharged downstream. The immediate initial problem after the large July storm was that when the dam breached, we were discharging untreated contact water downstream of the project area, which was technically a violation of our permit. The Station 19 dam was repaired immediately the day after the storm by installing sheet plates, and we notified the regulators of the breach as soon as possible. Given the intense storms that we received in our upfront communication, fortunately the regulators did not issue a notice of violation. Once the Station 19 dam was repaired, we had to deal with all of the contact water between the Station 10 and 19 dams. The photos on this screen show the dewatered section between Sections 10 and 19. Prior to the storm event, and you can see how it flooded after the storm event, and all this water needed to be dewatered and run through the treatment system, which was a problem because the overuse of the treatment system overwhelmed it. The carbon filters clogged with fines, requiring an unplanned carbon replacement. These consequences led to both cost impacts and schedule delays, as we could not work until the excavation area was completely dewatered. So to correct the action, in addition to repairing the station breached immediately after the dam failure and treating all that contact water, the construction team implemented several additional corrective actions, the first of which was constructing the additional dams upstream and downstream of this first excavation area. By this time, we'd received the property access for the upstream portion and could install the dam at Station 8, as you can see here in the photo, and also the bladder dam at Station 26. You can see a picture of that bladder dam filled with water, which crossed the entire creek, and this led us to dewater the entire creek of all three excavation areas at once. This gave us more redundancy should one of the dams breach or overtop during an upcoming storm event. We also worked with our water treatment system vendor to optimize the water treatment system so that we could more quickly treat water without clogging the system, treat contact water. And this was done through more frequent backwashing and bag filter changeouts. So following these corrective actions that were implemented in July and August, the team was able to move through the remediation successfully for several months. We completed the excavation in these top two reaches, and we're most of the way through excavation of the bottom reach by early November. However, we experienced another challenge in early November, the bladder dam failure. As we mentioned, this bladder dam was installed in late August, but on November 10th, water managed to seep underneath the bladder dam, which had held out water for more than 2 months. And it came from the downstream side and flooded the upstream side of that bladder dam. You can see this photo above shows the excavated bottom reach of the stream. And then the photo to the bottom right shows how that same area was filled with water after the November 10th breach. The cause of this breach never was officially determined, but it was likely due to the fact that the bladder dam was in place longer than originally planned, and the constant tidal action created pathways for water to make its way underneath the dam. This failure was another major setback for the project. The bladder dam had to be repaired, which was not as simple as repairing sandbag dams. The repair took multiple attempts over several weeks. But the construction team was finally able to repair it, as you can see in that bottom picture, by placing an impermeable liner on both sides of the dam and placing over 800 tons of sand upstream and downstream of that section of the bladder dam to cover the breach. Once the dam was finally fixed, we had to dewater that large amount of contact water had entered the excavation area. It took over a week given the large volume, likely over 1 million gallons of water. Even though we had learned to optimize the water treatment system by this time, still it took a long time to process that much water. So, eventually, after repairing and finishing that section, we were able to restore the creek and then remove the bladder dams and eventually successfully restored the wetlands and slope stabilization and completed the project, but not without those delays which impacted the cost of the project as well as coming in several weeks later than was planned. So what lessons did we learn from this? One, having a failure mode analysis at the beginning project was a great idea. And we happened to successfully identify the potential failures. We appropriately incorporated a 50% safety factor based on the outcome of this analysis. However, we learned that a 50% safety factor was insufficient to prepare for the storm events that occurred, much out of what used to be out of the norm. We also noted that we, in spite of identifying the need for contingency plans, we did not adequately discuss and develop contingency plans for dam failure in detail prior to initiation of the construction phase of the project. When the dam failed, we had to react quickly to solve the problems, but it took time. If we had had a contingency plan in place, we may have been able to reduce costs and schedule impacts. Lastly, unintended consequences of design changes must be fully considered. When we add the initial set of storm events that caused failure of the upstream sandbag dams, we decided to install the downstream bladder dam early. This worked well and protected us from the discharge of contact water. But given the added length of time that the bladder dam had been installed, it may have contributed to its failure prior to completing the project. In summary, we were able to overcome water management challenges during this project and successfully complete the work. But I would say with a bit more excitement and headaches than I would have liked. When planning for water management, future projects should more fully consider and build resiliency to the possible impacts from climate change as part of the planning effort. So Kate, we're ready for the next presentation.
Thanks, Cannon. That was a great presentation. Our next presenter is Kevin Kowalk. He's a senior engineer and project manager at EA Engineering Science and Technology. Since joining EA in 2013, Kevin is focused on contaminated sediment remediation and habitat restoration while supporting EA's various contracts with the EPA. He serves as EA's deputy program manager for EPA Region 5 for our three EPA RAF contracts that EA holds. His areas of expertise and experience in addition to sediments include soil and groundwater characterization remediation, and all these projects done for industrial, commercial, agricultural, and federal clients. He's a professional engineer in the states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. He has a bachelor's and master's both in biosystems and agricultural engineering from Michigan State University. So I'm going to put a plug in for this presentation for Kevin. This is an EPA project that was so successful in partnering that we actually use it for a lot of our project managers in training as a great project management case study. So, Kevin, tell us all about the project.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kate. And I wanted to thank everyone else for sticking with us on this last panel of the day here. So as Kate mentioned, I'm Kevin Kowalk. I'm a senior engineer and project manager with EA. And I'm going to be discussing partnering success and lessons learned at the former Zephyr Oil Refinery project site. I put this presentation together with Steve Shaw of Stephenson. He was their project manager on the remedial action. EA and Stephenson are part of a large project team that I'll be discussing throughout the presentation. One thing to note here on this first screen, that this is two photos of the project site. The photo on the left is pre-RA, and then the photo on the right is post-RA, right before we remove the cofferdam. So a quick look at the agenda, what I'll be talking about. I'll do an introduction to the project team. I'll do a quick overview and site background, and then I'll dig into the RD and RA, focusing on technical highlights and then lessons learned, including how the makeup of the project team and the various communication efforts impacted the project in multiple positive ways. So here's a look at the project team, and at the center you see EPA Region 5, and it's the Great Lakes National Program Office, and also the State of Michigan Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy Department. They are funding partners on this project through the Great Lakes Legacy Act, which funds contaminated sediment cleanup in the Great Lakes. And the Legacy Act requires a cost share from a non-federal sponsor or partner, and the state served in that role for this project. I did notice a lot of responses on the biggest circle RDRA challenges that was up earlier, and included a lot of funding related answers. And sometimes with that, the funding will sometimes bring in more stakeholders, and it can create very unique project teams, which is the case for this project. Along with EPA and Michigan Eagle, the Illinois Indiana Sea Grant, they led the community outreach efforts as part of this team. And then we had two local groups that served as on-the-ground support and also planning and outreach. The Army Corps of Engineers provided VE supports, value engineering supports, and RA oversight. And then EA and Stephenson were the two contractors with EPA We completed everything up through RD and RA oversight, and Stevenson completed the RA construction activities. Who you don't see on the screen, the landowner, who was also a stakeholder and had needs that we had to address during the RD and RA, and also the community in the vicinity of the site who had concerns that also needed to be addressed. So a quick project overview. The site is part of the Muskegon Lake AOC, or Area of Concern. Those were identified in the 1980s along with Canada. There are 43 total. They all have various beneficial use impairments that have been identified that need to be taken care of. Funds from both the Legacy Act and also the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and other funding sources are utilized to address both the contaminated sediments and the BUIs in these AOCs. You can check out the EPA websites for more information on those two programs. You can see here, while you're here, the site is up here in this area in this red box, but you can see how it's connected to Lake Michigan through the channel and then Muskegon Lake, and then here is where the Muskegon River comes in. And the site is right in this area right here. So I'll talk how connected the site is to Lake Michigan and the impacts due to that. Those will become clear towards the end of the presentation. So a little bit of site background. This was an oil refinery from the 1930s up through the early 1990s. During that time frame, they'd had over 2 million gallons of petroleum releases on the property here. And one thing to note about this, there is a groundwater divide that essentially cuts the site in half here with this portion of the groundwater flowing towards the Muskegon River in the wetland area. And this is our site right here, this wetland with this fire suppression ditch. And then the remaining groundwater flows in the opposite direction towards a creek to the north. The state is operating an ongoing recovery well system along the bottom of this bluff right here to basically stop that NAPL and groundwater from coming into the wetlands at this point in time. And they have a treatment system on the upland area here as well. And with that wetland being right here next to the Muskegon River and it's part of the Muskegon Lake AOC, it is the loss of fish and wildlife habitat beneficial use impairment that will be lifted eventually, and this project was part of that. Taking a quick look at the RD and some technical highlights. This was approximately 50,000 cubic yard dredging to remove petroleum and lead impacts. It was essentially the upper 2 feet of the wetland, and there was a distinct clean sand layer below the organic material that needed to be removed. There was also about 1,300 cubic yards of hazardous sediments that was for lead that we needed to treat in situ to avoid land disposal restrictions. We utilized a laying tool and stabilizing agent for that treatment. There was significant dewatering and solidification of the sediments. We had required minimum times on the pad, followed by addition of Portland cement to meet both transportation and strength requirements for disposal at the landfill. We had water treatment requirements that were necessary to meet MPDES discharge criteria. And then with the wetland restoration, it was about 13.6 acres. And the habitat before this at the site was a really monotypic wetland, invasive species throughout. So our wetland restoration was focusing on a more diverse wetland with native plants. And with the RD, it was very critical to note that maintaining the schedule was going to be a challenge due to the large-scale full site dewatering that we were doing. It was focused on a relatively dry removal, so there was a lot of water that was pumped out and treated and then discharged to the river. So any delays with the RA would just compound the budget issues on this. So it was critical to stay on schedule with this project. So some of the lessons learned during remedial design. To actively engage all stakeholders early on is the biggest takeaway with multiple components. The first is identifying your site owner or use needs early. In this case, there's a fertilizer operation, and they had significant water needs that were not necessarily a standard thing. It was kind of random when they would need that water, so we had to make sure that they had the water that they needed as we were actually cutting off their water supply from that fire suppression ditch when we were dewatering it. Also, is there other RA activities that need coordination? There was an upland RA that the state was completing beyond the water treatment process that they have. They were doing an in-situ chemical oxidation, and you'll see that. And then on the next slide, I've got some photos of that, so you can see how those areas kind of crossed and how we had a plan around that. As far as permits go, just recommend having front-end discussions on that. Engage those permitting agencies early on. We actually had a meeting to present the project before application submittal to catch any potential issues. For Superfund and permit equivalency, it's still a helpful thing to address those potential risks. Sometimes if you need to coordinate with states or other entities for RA efforts, you may still be required to meet certain, say, discharge criteria if you're doing water treatment, even if there's no permit that's required, for example. So it's still a good thing to go through that process early on. As far as access agreements go, I would just say triple check those. The example from this project was a railroad access agreement. And for entities like that, you have to drill down through multiple layers to make sure you have the correct entity that's giving you the access. And in this case, it ended up, I think, three or four layers before we got to the correct user that could give us the access to that railroad. Utilities coordination, just make sure you have all your details and approvals set. Some things require extra protection that need to be addressed in the RD. In this case, we had a buried petroleum pipeline that was pretty shallow, like 4 feet under where our haul road was going to be. So we had to address that early on in the design and make sure everything was set. Performance specifications, I'll skip over that. I'm going to have a full slide on that I'll talk about in a bit. Future land use. Sites and or adjacent sites incorporating what type of land use or future projects are going on. Incorporating what you're doing into that is a big thing. In this case, we left a haul road in place for a future adjacent project to use once we determined that it was clean. And then lastly, adjacent properties and kind of safety concerns. Just get all those concerns early in design. For this, we did a lot of outreach, which I'll also talk about, which led to significant air monitoring and then having dust and odor control measures in place based on those concerns. So just to talk about a couple of those issues here, just wanted to talk about the site uses and activities. So this was our dewatering pad, kind of in the middle of the large upland area that we had for staging. All the tanks that you see there, those were the for the fertilizer operation, and it also included this building here and a lot of this, and they utilized this road here. To note with our dewatering operation, this was our haul road from the wetland area, which was down this way. This was our haul road to the dewatering pad, and then our haul road out to the main road for exit to the landfill. This area here, you can see a bunch of white stickups. This was actually the upland RA that the state was completing. These are all injection wells. So you can see it's kind of right in the middle of all the other activities for this site. This is where the buried pipeline was, and we had to have protections in place for that for our haul road. And then we also had our discharge pipelines for the treatment plant going back to the river. So you can kind of see just how everything was interconnected and a lot of folks using the same area, so it took a lot of coordination for that. Talk a little bit here about performance specifications. Basically, those are utilized to allow for ingenuity and expertise to be utilized. Performance spec in its basics is really just having a criteria or a result that the contractor needs to meet. You might have some constraints with that perhaps, but the means and methods are basically left up to the contractor to meet that performance criteria. For this specific performance specification for dewatering, we didn't dictate the process for the dewatering beyond the area they had available, minimum construction requirements for the pad, which in this case we had a liner and also stone. Time requirements for gravity dewatering, we had a minimum number of days they had to dewater it by gravity in order to reduce costs. And then also the solidification agent, we had minimum and maximum quantities they could use, which was also to keep the cost in line and the budget under control on this. But other than that, it was really a blank slate for the contractor, and Sevensee did a great job on this. They utilized actually an asphalt pad So they took our design and went beyond it, and it worked out really well. And the way they managed everything on the pad worked out really well. So a lesson learned for us as design engineers is that we are actually now incorporating asphalt pad use for our dewatering pads in subsequent designs. So now just to talk about community outreach for a moment. We did a lot of different things for community outreach, and it really was a whole project team effort led by the Illinois Indiana Agency Grant and the EPA and the local folks. We had multiple flyers, public meetings, they even did door-to-door knocks, and they basically discussed the project with the community before it happened, and we had a public hotline during the RA for any concerns. You'll notice on here, this is our dewatering pad, and you can see some of the homes here, and this is basically directly downwind from our dewatering pad. So it's in very close proximity to the home. So in going through this extensive outreach, it helped EPA to identify potential risks and included risk reduction measures into the design and contracting. So we had air monitoring stations set up for baseline. We did pre-construction surveys for the air and also during the RA. We also had optional response actions included, including tenting or application of odor suppression foams, things like that that were ultimately not needed, but having those measures available was very critical. And all the outreach that we did led to a very informed community, and in fact, we received zero calls on that RA hotline during the entirety of the RA. So what are some of the remedial action coordination and management items? The first thing is communication and maximizing it. A third-party facilitated kickoff meeting was utilized for this, and that is highly recommended. I believe Glencoe utilizes those now on most of their construction projects. It sets expectations and the lines of communication, and it puts faces with names for a long-term project, so it's very valuable. We had three construction status calls per week. At first, I think both EA and Sevenson may have thought this was overkill, but it ended up being extremely valuable in keeping everyone up to speed. It allowed for quick responses to issues when they arose, and we utilized a standing agenda so everyone knew what would be discussed and it was up to speed. So there were multiple benefits to those three construction calls per week. We move on to remedial action lessons learned, and I'm going to hit a slide for each of these, but briefly, trust historical information, expect the unexpected, roll with the changes, be ready to adapt and react, and be mindful of reuse. So the first one is basically that trust your historical information. So, you know, we struck oil on the site, which really wasn't a goal. So what do we do now, and who do we call? We had maps during the RD of historical and abandoned oil well locations at the site. And right near the end of the RA, we had an apple coming up in the wetland in proximity to a mapped oil well location. So we did a little bit of investigation, and we dug a little bit deeper, and we did figure out that it was an oil well. Well, having all of the right entities involved on these three calls per week allowed the state to respond immediately and discuss with the other appropriate state agencies to get an emergency drill crew on site to over-drill and cap that well. And I think that drill rig was on site within 2 or 3 weeks. EA and Sevenson, we also had to coordinate and reconfigure one of the emergent wetland areas, and that was to essentially allow for this large drilling pad that was necessary to get this drill rig. I think this was like 110-foot mast on that drill rig. So it was a very large drill rig that we had to accommodate to get out into the middle of our wetland, and all that coordination happened very quickly. Expect the unexpected, asbestos. No one told us anything about asbestos on this site. But this was within, I think, week 1 or 2 of the RA. This was just started to dig for the dewatering pad, which we had to dig an area that was about 2 feet deep for a sump, and right away ran into asbestos-containing materials. But with the state on the calls and all the coordination happening, they were able to contract with Sevenson directly to complete that removal right away. EA and Sevenson then coordinated with the landowner to move that dewatering pad to an adjacent area, and we reconfigured it to limit the depth so we didn't discover anything else that we didn't want to. So the coordination of the team allowed for a fast response with minimal delay on that issue. The next thing is kind of roll with the changes. So this was a photo that I had on the first slide, but this is right near the end of the RA in 2018. Sometimes you can't stop nature. We had high water in this case, and this is where Lake Michigan and being so close to that comes into effect and how connected it is. We saw 1 to 1.5 foot increase in the water levels at the site over the design elevation from 2017 into 2018 when we were completing the RA. Once the RA was completed, there was an additional 1 to 1.5 foot increase in the water elevations following the RA and during the maintenance period. As most folks, I think, are aware, or maybe if not, the Great Lakes are at historically high water levels, and I think we just did the math on this for a final report that it was almost 4 or 5 feet higher than when we initially did our survey at the site. You used to be able to walk across this wetland with barely getting your boots wet, but now obviously you need a boat or you're swimming. What do we have to do to deal with this? Well, during the RA, we had to redesign this cofferdam. This cofferdam is a three-part cofferdam. The majority of it is an earthen cofferdam that you can see down here, but then we had some sheet pile and some super stacks along the railroad. Well, we had to redesign the earthen portion to bring a more coarse material in for the base that could be placed in the water, and then we brought our sand in with the liner on top of that. We also had to redesign our wetland features and our emergent wetlands. We essentially had to create these islands that you see here in order to bring that elevation up so that we could plant the emergent plant material and the submergent plant material and have it hopefully succeed and propagate, and then basically if the water level is then receded, they would be able to spread. But sometimes nature wins. So this was a photo from fall of 2019. You can see all of our emergent wetland areas are completely underwater, and it actually got worse from there. This year, this entire berm here was underwater as of August 2020. But recently, we did go out, and they've replanted along some of these edges here in response to that in order to utilize the funding we have. We had remaining to try to get some of that wetland plant material established. So. And then finally, I like to compare management of RD and RA, more so RA, to playing essentially the game whack-a-mole, where you basically have quick reflexes. And how do you do that? That's through efficient planning in the RD and communication in the RA, so you can react quickly with the correct resources to manage those issues as they pop up. So, and that basically leads you to then maintaining your schedule and budget and reaching your RA objectives. So. With that, I am finished.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. That was a great presentation. And batting cleanup for our panel is David Hines from Ramble. He is a professional engineer and has 27 years of experience in environmental engineering with a focus on site investigation and remediation. His expertise ranges from performing and managing initial due diligence through subsurface investigations and remedial actions at complicated sites under a variety of state and federal programs, including large Superfund remedial investigations and remedial actions. He has experience in the investigation and remediation of former mining sites and has managed wastewater treatment plants at former mining sites for the removal of metals contaminated water. He has also provided expert witness testimony in matters involving the distribution, fate, and source of soil and groundwater contamination. So, David, bring us home with a mining project management lessons learned case study.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, Kate. Appreciate it. I'm excited to be here. Unfortunately, I drew the short straw of having the last presentation on the last day of the conference. So appreciate those that have stuck around. I know it's getting late out east, so appreciate that. Hopefully, I'll have some great photos of a mine site in the Rocky Mountains to keep your interest. I'm going to be talking about the Eagle Mine Superfund site that's located just west of Vail, Colorado. This presentation is a bit of a departure from the others. This is not your traditional remedial design, remedial action construction, walk away. The main remedial design and remedial construction at this hazardous waste site occurred back in the late 80s, early 90s. So it's a little different. However, we do have continuing design and construction needs at the site. It's more of an operations site, but we do have continuous design and construction needs. We'll give just a bit of a history of the site to give you some context, talk about the remedy that was implemented at the site, and then some of the challenges and lessons learned that we've had there. So gold and silver mining occurred at the site starting in the late 1800s. Mining occurred all the way up until 1984 at the site. It transitioned to a lead and zinc mine when the gold and silver plays were played out. And most of the mining ended by the late 1970s. An individual purchased the mine hoping to make a fortune. Unfortunately, it did not work out well for him. He went bankrupt, abandoned the site, walked away. The problem was when he stopped paying his bills, the electric company shut the power off, and the pumps and motors that were dewatering the mine, electricity was shut off, and then the mine began to flood. We could spend numerous slides, an entire presentation talking about the regulatory history. We'll just give a brief overview. In 83, the state of Colorado filed an NRD lawsuit against the former mine operator. And then in 86, the site was added to the national priorities list. Initially, it was the state involved in the site, but then in the mid-1990s, the EPA joined suit, and now is kind of the more lead on the site. Most of the construction was complete in early 2000, 2001. An interesting twist: in 2004, a developer purchased parts of the site. The plan was to build a private ski resort. To give you a reference, those who aren't from Colorado or are familiar with the area, the site is right between Vail and Beaver Creek. So it's a very, very popular ski area. So they were going to build a private ski resort, and in order to get a lift ticket, you had to buy a condo. Once 2008 hit and the economy turned south, plans changed. There are still plans for residential development, and in 2009, the developer took over responsibility for that OU. And then to bring it to a close this year, decision was made by the agencies to really kind of consolidate all these previous agreements into one final consent decree for operations and maintenance, make it clean, and prepare for closure of the site at some point in the future. That just got lodged with the court end of September, and it's actually out for public comment right now, so this is a very timely discussion. We do have three operable units. The one that we are most concerned with is OU1, and that's the site-wide service water quality that's based on ecological risk, water quality in the Eagle River. OU2 is on the photo on the right. It's the old mining town of Gilman. In the right of that photo, you can see the main shaft, the Wilkes Bar shaft, and then the classic waste rock pile that's just outside of the mine shaft itself. And then the town itself, the miners would get up in the morning, walk up the street, get in the shaft, and go down and go to work. So that town still is there today, very popular trespassing location. And then the other OU is for the private developer. They are responsible for that, and it's human health-based risk. So it's always interesting to give, people like to see the before and after photos. The photo on the left is a roaster pile that was cleaned up, you see on the right there. This one is probably the most dramatic. This is down in the mine town of Belden. You can see the mine buildings in the background, and then this roaster pile went down actually and touched the Eagle River. You can just imagine during snowmelt or during rainstorms the amount of metals loading that would go into the Eagle River. And then the photo on the right there showing that it was removed and taken away. So that was a pretty dramatic change, pretty dramatic remedy success. All that material is brought to what was the tailings pile, the former tailings pile for the site. All that material was consolidated there, and now it's called the consolidated tailings pile. It was graded, covered, capped, and revegetated, and we monitor that vegetation every year. And then the far downstream downgrading into the site was some wetlands. The old tailings pile used to drain into these wetlands. You can see the amount of metals impact from that, and it got cleaned up. There's a little bit remaining in there that will have to meet residential standards at some point if they build residential on the fringes of that, but it was pretty successfully cleaned up. And then the treatment plant was built to treat the water. Bulkheads were installed on the mine. They more or less put plugs in the mine and put a pipe in there to drain the mine water out so that we could treat it. There is a groundwater collection system around that consolidated tailings pile. All that water is pumped to the pipe to the treatment plant. It's a traditional lime precipitation process where lime is added, pH is raised. The metals drop out, primarily the zinc, and then the water is filtered. We have an on-site sludge disposal, fortunately. We don't have to truck the filter cake waste anywhere. And then the plant does operate under a NPDES permit with the state of Colorado, which is fairly rare, uncommon for a Superfund site. Usually you don't have a permit, usually you're exempt, but that was negotiated early on in the process. We have numerous challenges. We could spend the entire conference talking about a lot of the challenges at the site. We're going to just focus on a couple based on the time that we have. We took over this site about 10 years ago and inherited an aging system, which represented a lot of challenges. We have a very dynamic environment. As the previous speakers, Kevin and Cannon, talked about, we have a changing climate that represents pretty significant challenges to us. We have a lot of safety and security concerns based on the size of the site and remoteness of some of its features. And then we don't have a pathway to walkway. This is in design and construct, and then come back and monitor it every once in a while or perform minor maintenance. We are continuously treating water 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that will never stop unless we can come up with a way to treat the mine in the mine itself. This requires continuous design construction projects, and we do have some pretty active stakeholders involved in the project. So as I mentioned, the treatment plant was built in 1991, so that's pretty old. There was deferred maintenance. There was a study. They had talked about moving the treatment plant closer to the mine to try and get rid of some of the pipeline. For those of you involved in mine work, you know that mine conveyance systems clog faster than arteries, and so they require constant maintenance. And so the thought was if the treatment plant could move closer to the mine, you can get rid of some of that pipeline. However, for various reasons, it was decided to keep the plant where it was, which allowed us to go into some design and construction projects to upgrade the plant to meet current standards. When we took it over, we found a lot of temporary fixes. It seemed like whenever there was a problem, there was just a temporary fix to get things back going again. So it was our challenge to turn those temporary fixes into permanent fixes. We've had a lot of staffing challenges in the Vail Valley. It's a very high-profile area. There's a very high cost of living there between Vail and Beaver Creek. There's another mine water treatment plant in the area where we have competition with trying to get their operators, and they try and get ours. So we've had challenges in the past. We have probably the strongest crew now we've ever had. We're holding on to them for dear life, but that's been one of our challenges. And then having to comply with those discharge standards. We're currently we're in negotiations to go from an NPDES permit to a permit equivalent document. Once the decision was made to keep the plant where it was, the client has put forth a lot of capital, a lot of money for capital improvements. The photo on the right is one of our equalization ponds. It's our emergency overflow pond when we need it. And then the photo on the left side of that, the photo, that's our active pond where we draw water from. You can see the orange color is coming from the mine. This pond was about 100,000 square feet. It holds 12 acre feet of water. So that was not an insignificant design and construction project. We've upgraded electrical, new control systems, new SCADA systems, new programming, a lot of safety improvements to our acid room, to remote level sensing of our lime silos. Coated the tanks. In the photo in the upper right, you can see the we sandblasted and recoated the tanks to get them to last longer. This is our clarifier. You can see the clear water there. And then this is our first reaction tank where the lime is added and it's aerated to start dropping out those metals. In the lower right of the photo is our new VFDs, variable frequency drives for our influent pumps that come into the plant. The whole goal of all this work is to make the plant more reliable. That graph in the middle of the slide, what you're seeing, that's the downtime. What we want is a flat line across the bottom of there that indicates the plant is running reliably, no shutdowns. It's running 24 hours a day. Here in the middle, we had some brief shutdowns, but that was due to just a power outage in town. We monitor, we record every time we have an outage. We track that so that we can look back over time to determine, are there issues that are recurring that we need to address as part of design and construction projects to make the plant more reliable? As Cannon and Kevin both talked about, with the changing climate, we have very, very big extremes from summer to winter at the site. For those of you here in Colorado in the West, the photo on the left there was not taken this summer, although you would have expected it was, and even those out east who've gotten the smoke from California and Colorado. That was a couple of years ago. I was up on a Saturday working at the plant, and literally across the street from our plant, a wildfire occurred, and was there firsthand to see some of the dramatic fire response activities. In contrast, the photo on the right was two winters ago. There was avalanches that occurred all over the state. It's kind of hard to see, but in the center of that photograph from left to right, there was an avalanche that came down. It actually crossed the river. Eagle River's right here. It plugged the river until the water forced its way through. But somewhere under this 20 or 30 feet of snow and debris, there was a manhole, part of the conveyance system, and it was telling us that there was an active release going on. We didn't think it was. We thought the cable was just broken, but had no way to know until we could get a loader in there to carefully dig and find that manhole and confirm the fact that we didn't have an active release going. But we have challenges, whether it's summer or winter at the site, to maintain operations. And the site is roughly 235 acres. It's very, very large, so we have a lot of issues with safety and security. Our people are going to remote locations to take readings of the pipeline system to check for leaks. It is a very popular area. The mine is really cool. I have photos of it on my mantle at home. It's a beautiful site, so a lot of people want to get in there, but it is a super fun site with a lot of health and safety concerns, so we have to kick people out. Not only do we have two-legged trespassers, we have four-legged trespassers. If anybody noticed in this photo, We had a game camera set up to monitor for trespassing, and we caught this mountain lion early one morning walking across the site. I'll tell you, that is the way you want to capture a mountain lion, is on camera, not in person when you're doing your rounds across the site. So these are some of the challenges that we face on a daily basis, the harsh winters, the remote locations. We have a contractor going out next week to do some rockfall mitigation so that as we drive by some of these steep cliffs that we don't have to worry about rockfall coming down and hitting our personnel driving by. And all that is to keep the mine pool down so that it doesn't overflow and go into the Eagle River. The graph on the left is all the way back to when the treatment plant was started back in the early 90s. We want to keep the mine pool below 8510, 8500 feet. That's where we start to see seeps in the mountainside that go straight to the river and affect the water quality in the Eagle River. So we get that mine pool down. We took the plant over in this time frame, got it down, and then had one of the biggest snow years on record, but then got it down. And then this event that recently, this was the snow year from 2 years ago. So we had a pretty sharp increase and have been working it down ever since. So this is our continuous challenge is keeping the plant running, keeping the mine water going to our treatment plant so that we can maintain compliance with our discharge permit and keep the water quality in the Eagle River good. I mentioned that we have continuous design and construction needs. In 2018, the PRP entered into a friendly unilateral administrative order. In looking at the data, water quality in the Eagle River, it continuously, routinely meets water quality standards except right before snowmelt, right at the start of snowmelt. So it's determined that one of the alternatives was to treat the groundwater that was entering the river at those locations. So the PRP agreed as part of one of the alternatives to install some wells to pump the water from that area. Problem is there's no power in that area, so I had to design and construct a new pipeline because the old pipeline was plugged and not reliable, and then install 3,500 feet of power line to run those pumps, and then pump groundwater to our treatment plant so that we can treat it. Unfortunately, we weren't able to monitor this year because of COVID, so it was installed, but we didn't know if it worked, so we're anxious to sample it next year. On the lower right is it was another project, installed a new pipeline from the trestle that goes over the Eagle River, installed a new pipeline there, and then ran that all the way to the treatment plant. On the right of that photo is Jamie Miller. She's our EPA project manager. We were there braving the cold on one of our annual inspection days, but inspecting this design and construction project. And this shows just an inset of some of that work. These green dots over here are the new wells that were pumped in the mine area. And then it goes from the Belden area, which is the mine, 3,500 feet down to where our main mine water pipeline is tied into that. And then from there, it goes a couple miles down to our treatment plant. So those are the types of projects that we have to do on a routine basis. As I mentioned, we have very active stakeholders, a lot of state, federal agencies. The photo on the right is our annual fish shocking that the Colorado Parks and Wildlife does that has shown that the fish population has come back. The Eagle River Water and Sanitation District is one of our active stakeholders. They actually use water in the Eagle River for their water supply, so they are understandably interested in the operations at our treatment plant. We have a watershed council. We have River Watch. We have the private developer. We have Vail Ski Resort. We have the Beaver Creek Ski Resort. So we have very, very active stakeholders there, a lot of them. And we engage them with monthly updates that is provided to the watershed council. We have quarterly stakeholder meetings that go over our operations at the plant. We report our releases. We have public tours every other year and give presentations to the middle school. So the lessons that we've learned are not groundbreaking. They're not earth-shattering. Kind of common sense, tried and true methods to meet our numerous challenges at the site. Preventative maintenance is critical, understanding when we took it over what spares we needed, understanding that if we had a pump go out on Christmas Eve, would we be able to get it before, you know, January 1st? So coming up with that list, knowing what we need to do to keep the plant running, having that trained crew, being able to troubleshoot, and then if they can't do it, having contractors that we have on speed dial that can come in to help us out. Pandemics do happen. As Kevin was mentioning, you got to roll with the changes. We enacted plans to make sure we had all our critical supplies on hand, not knowing if there was going to be travel restrictions. We learned to be ingenious. We have, it's based on the age of the plant. We have new and difficult problems all the time, and they require ingenious solutions. Flexibility is a big one. When EPA came out with their adaptive management back in 2018, this Eagle site is the poster child for adaptive management, being able to continuously reevaluate and prioritize site activities to account for new information and changing site conditions. So that's been key. We can come in on a day and have a plan for the day or the week, and it changes, and we roll with it and make sure that we meet our obligations. Being persistent, having our plans, following through with them. As soon as snow melts, we're planning for snowfall the next year, and during the winter, we're planning for snow melt. So we're always looking ahead to make sure we meet those obligations. And being transparent, communication is critical. The times where we don't communicate effectively is when we kind of lose that trust. I think Kevin said maximizing communication, I think, is critical here. So those are some of the lessons we learned. So thank you again for sticking through to the end. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Kate.
Thank you so much, David. We're going to transition to the Q&A and turn our cameras on. So what I wanted to do quickly was to pull up the questions that we asked earlier, just so not only our audience would know, but also our panelists. So the first question we ask is, how many years of experience, project management experience in design and construction under CERCLA do you have? And I thought it was interesting that we had 21 newbies, so no project experience. We had 48% had over 10 years of experience, so we'll call them veterans. And then we had that other about 40% somewhere in the middle from 1 to 10 projects. So we've got a good array of project managers here with different levels of experience. I think also one of the things that was really interesting to me in this presentation was, you know, change is going to happen. Be prepared for it. So I think Kevin said planning and design, and Cannon said planning and design, communication and construction, and then proactive management, even if you're in post-construction for a project like David, where, you know, design and construction is an ever-evolving process when you're dealing with some of the challenges that you did. So I think you guys really hit on some great project management. So what I'd like to do before I get into some harder questions is we had two clarifying questions. The first one's for Cannon. The person that asked the question said they had a similar project to yours where they had to control 10 to 15 million gallons per day. What was the flow rate of your creek again?
The base flow varied quite a bit seasonally. It wasn't very much. It's just a trickle really during as the base flow during the drier periods. And it was the tidal action that filled up most of that area. I don't know the numbers right off the top of my head what the range is from one season to the other.
Okay, thank you, Cannon. And then the second clarifying question was during Kevin's presentation. Kevin, the question was mitigation banking considered?
It was not necessary, and the initial meeting we had with the state agency for the permit, they indicated that it would essentially be self-mitigating, so we didn't have to consider a mitigation bank.
Okay, great. So I actually have a question for all of the panelists. When you look at one of the questions we asked, we said, do you specifically consider impacts of climate change in preparation of design and remedial action work? And 11% said yes in all projects. 57% said yes in some projects, and I got to move down, 32% said no. So the question I have for all three of you is, Cannon's presentation was focused on climate change impacts, but given that David had a mining site and Kevin, you also had a sediment site, those are sites that are prime for water management issues and changes related to climate. And climate change can sometimes be sort of a tricky issue to navigate. Do you have any recommendations, Kevin, first for you, being an A&E consultant for the EPA, how did you discuss climate change in your project when you were executing the design and doing your planning? And did you get any, you know, what was the dynamic? Did you get any pushback?
Not really pushback, no. We knew we had to consider the effects of climate change, and we actually, with the issues in the Great Lakes, where we're at, it's not a coastal type thing. It was internal coastal, but we considered the fluctuations. We looked back at 100 years of data to see what the elevations were of the Great Lakes to make sure we were hitting those restoration goals. So we looked at a lot of data. We talked to NOAA. We talked to the Army Corps just to get a feel for what we should target as our elevations when we did the restoration work. So we did a lot of work, and it was all kind of part of the RD, and everyone on the team kind of understood that, you know, we need a plan for as best we can for a future scenario, and unfortunately, just that scenario was even worse than we planned for. So, but it was taken into consideration, and there was little pushback at all.
Okay, thank you. And then, Cannon, for you, obviously we saw some of the impacts of flood events at your site that perhaps were not designed to the level that was realized. Being the owner's representative for a project and having to work with the owner, and, you know, for a site like yours and really a site with a lot of climate change, dealing with climate change, whether it's in a containment remedy or in a design, equals more money, right? So can you talk a little bit about, in the failure modes analysis, when some of these things came up, like what was the conversation like, and what are some recommendations for selling the benefit of something that's proactive versus reactive?
Now, that's a great question, Kate. And obviously, clients in general are concerned with costs and with budgets, and particularly changes to those costs. If you come in late with additional costs, that's usually the worst news for clients. And so I think one of the keys is to plan as far up front as you can for climate change and resiliency so that you can build those costs into the plan from the beginning and avoid those later perturbations from the plan based on surprises. And I think, you know, the good news is that more and more clients and consultants are understanding the long-term impacts of climate change. And if you don't plan for it, that it can end up costing more money in the long run. And so but I think what's still missing is it's not yet a fundamental part of the process of what we do. And I think there's more effort needed to build resiliency into each step of the design and subsequent steps in the project.
Okay, thank you. And then David, for you, being a contractor for a responsible party, a lot of times when you think about a mining site, you think that it was an old mining company that was a responsible party. But here, you know, your responsible party was like a larger maybe entity that wasn't as familiar with maybe some of the impacts of water management when you're dealing with mine added discharge and the different volumes of water that you're going to need to deal with. So sort of the same line of questioning for you. As you're moving through this continuous design and construction project with managing mine influenced water, like what are some of the tools or techniques that you use when trying to integrate that into a continual optimization process with the owner?
The owner, it's interesting. The owner is Viacom CBS, so CBS is responsible for this. So they very much understand what's needed, and so they are fine with investing to make sure that we meet our obligations. And when it comes to climate change, we have seen the effects on an annual basis. This is not something that we see once every 10 years. It seems like every year or two we're seeing this. So they recognize that we need to be prepared, and whether that's buying additional pumps, additional equipment that we're ready to respond to some of those issues. They understand that, and they want to meet their obligations. So they're good with doing those types of things.
Okay, great. My next question is going to be for Cannon and Kevin. Cannon, I'll go first to you. You talked about a recommendation of your project management lessons learned is out of your failure modes analysis. It sounds like you didn't have contingency plans that were perhaps, maybe you talked about it, but it wasn't well documented. Do you think that documentation and, you know, me coming as a moderator from the federal government, contingency planning in the context of contracting and being able to respond flexibly, the more we can plan things into things like acquisitions, you know, the easier it is. Would you suggest, say, for a client like the federal government, if you were doing failure modes analysis, doing some contingency planning and documenting that in a way that might support the agency in doing some contracting, methods that might allow you to respond more quickly? I guess would be my question.
Yeah, I think it's important that the design itself includes the contingency planning such that it gets written into the construction, our remedial action contract. And that's tricky how to do that right, to have those optional tasks or optional when it comes to bidding the remedial action of things, the tasks that may or may not end up being needed. But you know, in our case, we built in to have the contingency equipment on site for additional bypass capacity. And obviously that wasn't enough, but in terms of contingency planning, it's that is a challenge, but I think the designs need to spell those out more carefully in the RD document particularly, but even in the record of decision, there's often important need to have contingencies built in at that stage as well.
Okay, great. And then Kevin, for you, we talked a little bit about contingency in the context of dealing with potential stakeholder challenges, being that you had neighboring properties adjacent to the remediation area. I guess building on what Cannon said, there was, you mentioned that from a EPA contracting perspective, some of the additional air monitoring and the potential tenting, if you had any air monitoring exceedances, were built into the contract. Did you also build that into the design, or was that just sort of a communication with the project team that gave them the insight to put that in there?
Yeah, that wasn't really built into the design to too much of an extent. Some of it was on the air monitoring and dust suppression side. We definitely identified a few things in the specifications that they could implement as an optional type of task. There was some identification of that, but that allowed the contracting folks to have that built in as optional line items, I believe, for the contractor if it was necessary. They knew that there were minimum requirements to meet based on the specifications, but it was something that was an optional thing as a contingency.
Okay, great. And then I have a question for David. David, question for you. Being in Colorado and having wild seasonal variations and a lot of things like wildfires this year, has Ramble put together any fire plans in terms of like inventorying? I mean, you have a lot of equipment in a big site, and in a fire situation, a lack of planning could be a little chaotic in trying to pick up the pieces. So we had a presentation at Design and Construction Denver last year that talked about what Iron Mountain Mine did when they had the big fires in 2018. Are you guys doing any proactive planning, and what types of documents or planning are you doing?
Sure. Following the fires we had a couple years ago, we put together a fire response plan. So part of it, most of it, is the health and safety of our people to make sure that they don't get in situations. There is some remote locations that if a wildfire hit, those move pretty quickly to make sure, that our people are safe. But then, what we need to do to protect the assets, obviously we don't want to have a release of the Eagle River, so can we shut off the pipeline to stop any flow of water in case, that trestle burns down and the water's going over that trestle. So we lay out in that plan what the response is when we have a fire. And that's an appendix to our overall, that we have an emergency response plan that if we have releases, what we do associated with that. So that fire response plan is part of our overall contingency planning.
Okay, great. Awesome. And just to close out for you guys, we asked the biggest project management challenges to overcome to successfully deliver a project. And it sounds like managing scope creep, dealing with funding that's not optimal, managing schedules, so the big three, scope, schedule, and budget. But people also talked about a lot of challenges that your case studies brought up, managing stakeholders, how to manage over-reliance on public and stakeholder input, regulatory review, incorporating reuse. So I think a lot of all three of your presentations were super relevant and hit on a lot of the challenges that the fellow project managers in the audience identified. So I think three great case studies, and we really appreciate it. And I thank you guys.
Thanks.
So Gene, we're gonna finish up the panel six and close out the symposium. So thank you, everyone. Again, thank you to David, Kevin, and Cannon for a great last panel. We are closing out the seminar. We've had 3 days and 6 great panels. As I mentioned in the beginning of today, we started with some groundwater success stories on day 1 and some combination technology applications. Yesterday, we talked about thermal remediation and some things to look out for in design and construction. We then moved into the use of modern technology, and today we really focused on project management case studies, a variety of different types of sites, mining sites, sediment sites, groundwater sites, but all of them focused on, you know, all of these intangible, the non-technology challenges that you might have to deal with successfully implementing a project. So I think, you know, the big takeaway here from design and construction and sort of how we structured the agenda was to give you guys a flavor of technology-specific case studies, as well as a lot of case studies on just project management that you can take home and apply to your project with some best management practices. So in closing, thank you again to all of our attendees. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Eagle Synergistic, Incero Solutions, Vista Geoscience, HGR, Groundwater Treatment and Technology, FRX, Weston Solutions, EA Engineering Science and Technology, AECOM, Black & Veatch, CDM Smith, Geosyntech Consultants, TRS Group, Leidos, Hydrogeologic Inc., Seventh and Environmental Services, and Northwind. Please visit our DCHWS website, dchws.org. You can find out more information about our sponsors and also more information about some future events. So speaking of future events, as we mentioned before, the virtual symposium is one of a number of events that we do throughout the year. One event that's coming up and is going to be ongoing in 2021 is our seminar series. What we do is we have up to two-hour seminars once every other month on various design and construction topics. Right now, we have a call for abstracts out, and abstracts are due November 6th. So if you want to take a deep dive into a design and construction project management issue, bring in a collection of case studies, we welcome your abstracts and would love to see you on a future seminar series. Likewise, as we mentioned before, we typically have an East and West in-person symposium. We are continuing planning, and this date is wrong, it should say 2021. We're continuing planning for our Philadelphia DCHWS East event, which is March 29th through 31st of next year. Right now, we're planning to do it in person. Of course, we have some contingency plans to move it virtual if that is not the case. After this event is concluded next week, we're going to be sending out a call for abstracts for that. We'll have a series of potential topics, and just remember, if you're interested, one presenter, a 20-minute topic on a variety of design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites. So I encourage you to look out for that call for abstracts. Again, I'm going to keep the dchws.org website updated for upcoming events as well as when call for abstracts or save the dates are out. So bookmark it and visit it to get more up-to-date information. Likewise, EPA's Clue-In platform and an associated TechDirect email that comes out monthly. We do our best to also push those upcoming events out through that. So with that, I'd like to thank all six panelists, our moderators and presenters, as well as the DCHWS Planning Committee, the SAME Philly Post, and the SAME Denver Post. And I'd also like to thank Gene Ballant for doing a superb job technically moderating the last 3 days. Again, Gene's going to go in some closeout, but if you have any suggestions, please let us know in the evaluation form. We read all of them. Thank you, and I turn it over to Gene.
All right. Thank you so very much, Kate. I promise I will keep this brief. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, we already have those posted on the seminar homepage. I've included a link to that in the Q&A. It's also on the upper right under related URLs. I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form. Again, you'll find that linked on the right side of your screen and in the Q&A. If you fill out that feedback form, there is a box at the bottom of that form that if you mark it, will allow you to certify you were here for the whole live session, and then as soon as you submit feedback, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. I do not issue CEUs or PDHs for these sessions. However, many of our participants are able to download the slides, keep a copy of their registration emails, and use these participation certificates to document their attendance and then get accreditation or credit for participating with their own institutions. So again, please be sure to visit that feedback form, share your thoughts with us. I want to thank all of you who actually helped participate in the test of a new online version of Adobe. You've given us a lot of very important user feedback so that we can continue to improve these online sessions. Today's session was recorded, just like the others in the series, and everyone who registered for today's session will automatically get an email as soon as